welcome aboard, you people. Starship Rokan Show. Off for another day of broadcast insolence. And a week, I suppose, thereof as well. Although, programming note, a couple things, programming note, looking forward to the week ahead. We've got a confirmation from Kim Fox's people that she will be here on Thursday now. So she was supposed to be with us last week, did not arrive, actually before last, did not arrive. So we are anticipating that she'll be here on Thursday. And if she's not here on Thursday, look out. That's the way that we look at it here. That's not a threat. That's just a reality. That's an editorial reality. Now, the other piece that's important to note here is that Ben Bradley will be joining us in just a few minutes here. And Ben and I will both be out of the country on Friday. We will we'll tell you when we return on Monday exactly what happened. But we're going on a very special investigative trip.
If you return, you mean?
Yes. If we return, we are going to a third world country, and we are anticipating being either joining a junta or being driven around by a junta in this third world country. So we'll tell you all about that. And I don't wish to tease people about this. I wish to be able to bring you an amazing story next week. That's Ben and my great promise to you. All right, coming up on this program, as I mentioned, Ben's going to be here. He's got a very special story tonight about a suburban cop who turned CIA agent and then was killed in action. And there's an amazing backstory to how these documents and his story has now come out. Stone Pony is going to be here. Alex Stone from ABC News talking about the Princess Cruise ship off the coast of Japan that has Americans on board with the coronavirus. And what's happened to some of these people with the coronavirus, they went on social media to, I suppose, do what you do on social media, complain about things, and they complained about having the coronavirus on social media. Well, now, when they did that, they then got death threats about coming back to the United States from their own followers on Facebook. What a stupid world we live in. We'll talk about that. And then we'll take you down to Springfield with Mark Maxwell, our guy, our man in Springfield, to talk about the fact that it turns out Illinois does not have a plan for gambling. Sure, they made it legal in the legislature, but they don't have a plan. We knew it when they actually made it legal in the legislature. They didn't have a plan to implement it. Now we find out that they still don't have a plan, even though they did this 6 months ago, 9 months ago almost now. Wow. All right. And then a couple of different things we have to talk about. We're going to talk about with Mr. Hoag and Mr. Powell and Ms. Lapka a little bit later on. Well, first of all, pitchers and catchers report this week. That's one thing. But the XFL debuted this weekend. And it was brightly colored, but it looked like Division III football to me, and we will discuss exactly what that actually means for the NFL. Very interesting thing, and there's another story that could affect the Bears. Phillip Rivers leaving the Los Angeles Chargers, nay, San Diego Chargers. And let me just tell you something. I think that would be a perfect solution for the Chicago Bears as a guy to maybe a two-headed quarterback situation, as Mitchell Trubisky still continues to grow as a quarterback and an individual, because that's what I'm most worried about. And then later on in the program, Mr. Richard Roper will be here. Oscars recap. I got to tell you something right here and right now. Last night's decision that was revealed last night, the decision by the voting members of the Academy, the Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, is one of the most confounding ever to me, to name Parasite best film of the year. There's ripples in Hollywood as a result of it today, because it's kind of crazy. I mean, it won best international film, as they call it now. I used to call it foreign language film, but now it's international film, and that's great. And quite honestly, it probably is the best. It's the only one of those I've seen, so I'm going to say that that's the best because it's the only one I've seen. However, I've seen all the Oscar nominees, and Parasite was not the best, not even close to the best. Sort of the middle of the pack. I mean, I don't know. I liked it a little bit better than Little Women, but I guess maybe because I've seen all the other Little Women, although maybe that was even better. It's interesting. And it's a little wacky. It's like a Jordan Peele movie, kind of, which is fun. But then it does something that it shouldn't have done. And it won Best Picture. I believe that this is self-hating is what's going. That's what Hollywood is all about right now, is self-hatred. All day long, Hollywood has to flagellate itself about how awful it is because of, you name it. Harvey Weinstein or Oscars too white or whatever. There's always some complaint that they bring upon themselves. But this is that. But they don't have to do that to us, do they? I'll explain that with Mr. Roper coming up a little bit later on. And also, it's interesting because he's bringing with him today. He mentioned this documentary about foosball, and. The documentarians, that apparently this movie is great about foosball. I mean, the last thing I saw that was even halfway decent about foosball was one of the episodes of Friends. But this is a whole documentary about foosball, and the documentarians are here in Chicago today doing a premiere. So we're gonna find out more about that. That comes way later in the program, though, at 6 o'clock. So come back for that if you can't stay all the way through. But if you can stay all the way through, you have an opportunity to win Blackhawks tickets as well. Thanks to our friends at Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing. But first, let's check in now with Lauren Lapka. She's got the traffic and the weather.
A life of service brought out of the shadows, how Darren Labonte went from policing suburban streets to hunting terrorists for the CIA. WGN-TV investigates tonight at 9.
Oh, it sounds like something Ben Bradley would do.
It does indeed.
There's Ben Bradley right there on the Super Celebrity Satellite, right there from Bradley Place. That's the home of WGN-TV, and we're the home of WGN Radio, and we talk every day around this time. Now, tell me what it is, Ben Bradley, that this story is all about, because I read the little dissertation of it, and I've never heard this story before.
And that's what struck me. So this came to me after Christmas, when somebody I know in the U.S. Marshals Service had sent out an email to colleagues saying, as we get ready to spend time with family and friends over the holidays, please keep Darren Labonte's family in your thoughts and prayers. And then it proceeded to have about a three or four sentence description of this guy's story. And I had never heard it before. So Darren Labonte was an Army Ranger. And then he got married, had a daughter, and became a police officer in Libertyville. And worked in Libertyville for a little while. And then the September 11th attacks happened. And he felt like he had to get back into the fight. Everyone we've talked to who knew him said, having a newborn was a big factor in that. So Darren looked around for ways he could get back into the fight and joined the U.S. Marshals Service here in Chicago. Quickly rose up, was on task force. These are the guys who go after fugitives, drug dealers, and the like in the city, suburbs, and still felt like he wasn't getting close enough to making a difference in the war on terrorism. Applied for and got accepted into the FBI. Now, any of these, right, would be an accomplishment in and of themselves.
Sure.
An Army Ranger, a suburban police officer,
right.
An FBI agent. And then his friends from the Marshals Service kind of lost track of him after he had gone into the FBI. Only years later would they find out that Darren's time with the FBI was short, as he got reassigned and joined the Central Intelligence Agency and did in fact get back into the fight against terrorists. And in 2009, the hunt was on for Al-Qaeda's leadership. We didn't have bin Laden at that point. And he was teamed up with a Jordanian intelligence agent who was really well regarded and by coincidence was a cousin to the king of Jordan.
Okay.
And that was his partner. And so Darren and this Jordanian intelligence agent, did a lot to try to hunt down Al-Qaeda agents. The Jordanian agent thought he had flipped a local Jordanian doctor who had a following on insurgent websites, thought he had turned him into a double agent where he could infiltrate Al-Qaeda. And quickly, he began sending back intelligence gold. He was with Ayman al-Zawahiri, new locations of Al-Qaeda leaders. And the CIA took a lot of interest because the hunt was on, right? Think about this a decade ago, as the people who had been responsible for 9/11 at the top had largely still escaped justice. And so the CIA went to great lengths to meet this doctor and learn what he could. Could they bring him to Zawahiri and to bin Laden? Mm-hmm. So this was a scene
before
fictionalized.
They had, this is before they had.
Yeah, so this was a scene fictionalized in the movie Zero Dark Thirty.
Right.
So the CIA instructs the Jordanian agent and Darren Labonte to set up a meeting at the CIA base in Khost, Afghanistan. There were lots of concerns. How do we treat this guy? This guy insisted on being treated like a friend. He said, "I've given you intelligence. I've helped you. I don't want the Afghan soldiers who are guarding the gate to see my face and then report back to Al-Qaeda that, you know, I'm a CIA or a Jordanian asset." And so Langley made the decision, not the team on the ground, Langley made the decision to treat him like a hero. So he came right through the gate, right into the CIA base within the larger military base there, and it turned out to be a trap. He detonated a suicide bomb, and it led to the largest loss of life in the CIA in decades. 7 CIA agents and operatives were killed, including Darren Labonte. And normally we don't hear these stories, right, because their families don't know them or have to keep them secret. In this case, it was high profile enough that the CIA released Darren's name. And now his widow talked with us, his mom, his dad, his 12-year-old daughter, who was only 2 years old when her dad died.
Oh, wow.
Spoke with us. So it was just a remarkable story that, you know, as a Chicagoan, I never knew his Chicago roots. And I think it's so important for us to take a moment and realize, you know, these folks who are working out on behalf of our government, whether it's the CIA or the military or whatever, like, these are real people with real families who are just out there trying to do the best they can.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, if you've seen the movie Zero Dark Thirty, it's funny. I was just talking with a friend last night about Zero Dark Thirty, because it's one of those films that, you know, when you think about the, there are not a whole lot of great 2010s and the war movie has become a little out of focus, I think, in Hollywood. There have been a couple great ones, you know, Hurt Locker, but Zero Dark Thirty tells a story. It's really an amazing story about the hard work that the men and women of the CIA do and how difficult it is. Charlie Wilson's War and Zero Dark Thirty are the two best movies ever about the CIA. And you get a sense of exactly, because we can't really know about them.
You're right. Not everything's right in these movies, but yeah, you do get a flavor of what they're up against.
Yes.
And how they take tiny morsels of information and patch it together.
And how they're not guys in suits on a bridge in Berlin anymore.
No, they're
right?
not.
They're almost indistinguishable from the special operators who are on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq and all the other places around the world, in West Africa and all the places, Southeast Asia, where there are troops, our troops that are fighting the war on, you know, we call it the war on terror, but it means a lot of different things, and it manifests itself in a lot of different ways. And these guys, as a matter of fact, it should be remembered, in the aftermath of September 11th, when we went into Afghanistan, those first days at the end of September in 2001, when we were there and dropping people on the ground, the first American casualty was a CIA forward operating operative.
Yep.
And that's a you know, super important thing to remember, that, you know, there is much in the fight. They're the tip of the spear. They're often in places where it's you know, super, super scary. Syriana. We talked to Bob Baer quite a bit on this radio program. Bob Baer is one of the probably the most decorated sort of secret agent of the CIA that you know about, right? Whose name you know.
Right. Because, and we don't normally get to know them.
Right. And Bob Baer wrote a book that ended up being made into a movie by George Clooney. I mean, it was just, and he has an amazing story. And what happened, as a matter of fact, what happened to Bob Baer was so horrifying in a lot of ways when he got taken captive by terrorists in the Middle East, that in a scene that George Clooney was reenacting, that George Clooney was injured and had to miss months of the shooting of the film. I mean,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, so the...
But to your point, that the entire nature of spycraft, if you even want to call it that, but of the CIA mission changed so dramatically. In fact, in the after-action reports, as the CIA did a lot of introspection about how they got taken by this double agent who turned out to be a triple agent, well, that was one of the things was, you know, yeah, we're not meeting on bridges in Berlin. We're not, you know, luring people with just money at diplomatic cocktail parties overseas. The very nature of what we do and who our adversary is changed so quickly. And it took years to basically change the approach of the way that they did business.
Yeah. Well, this fascinating story. This is coming up tonight.
Tonight on the WGN News at 9 o'clock, we'll have that story.
All right, very good. And we should also mention that there's a couple of other stories that are that are worth mentioning. Is there another carjacking downtown?
Yeah, we're just getting word of it, a carjacking in the Gold Coast neighborhood. And the details are still coming in pretty sketchy. But it sounds like there's a guy driving a very expensive version of a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And may have been carjacked at gunpoint. Our Pat Elwood is at the scene. He's gathering more information. He'll join us at the top of our newscast at 4 o'clock. We're also looking into what was an especially violent weekend in the city. Yeah. 9 killed, 14 wounded. Plus, in Harvey, you know, long home, kind of your hub.
Yeah.
Your hub for late-night liquor and exotic entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
There is a move afoot to attempt to rein that in.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's going to be a very short rein.
Well, yeah.
That's going to be a passing cloud.
Well, they've got a new mayor down there.
I know they
do. And remember with the story we did a week or so ago in Markham, right next door, where they're going through something similar, and it's causing folks to kind of figure out, okay, what kind of town do we want to be?
Yes, let's rethink ourselves. Yeah. All right, Ben. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it. We got the news coming your way on the WGN TV news at 4 o'clock. Starts at 4 o'clock with Ben Bradley, and then all the way through the afternoon into the evening and at night. And we've got the WGN radio news in 2 minutes from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. It's the Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. All right. Oh, there's more hysteria now about the coronavirus, as we just heard in the news. Someone was taken off a flight at Midway from New York for being ill. Now, there's no direct connection here at this moment to the coronavirus, but this just tells you about where the hysteria actually lives. And then there was a story about this Princess Cruise line that is off the coast of Japan. It's a ship that's off the coast of Japan. It's got a number of Americans on it. Apparently, it has a number of Americans who now have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, including people who have gotten on social media telling everybody that they've been diagnosed with the coronavirus and are being threatened about returning to the United States by other people on social media. It's just one of the reasons that we, on this program, are going to promise, Alex Stone from ABC News, I bring you in to talk about this. We, on the Rokan Show, promise to eliminate social media from your life before the end of this year, before 2021. That's what we're going to do.
Well, yeah, because, look, those folks aren't coming back until they have gone through the quarantine period or they have been treated and then they're doing better. So the numbers that we now have from Diamond Princess, they've been quarantined since February 4th. Now, 135 people are infected on board. 24 of them are Americans. And once it's confirmed that they've got it, then they're taken off. Then they go through the health process in Japan. But you talk about them, it's not only them being threatened. We got we were given a letter today that they went to the people of Riverside County in California, where those evacuees, the first plane flight, the 747 that landed with the U.S. diplomats went there to March Air Reserve Base. Their quarantine period is going to end tomorrow, but the workers at March Air Reserve Base have been threatened, accosted, called all kinds of things. People saying, don't let them into your whatever, whether it be your party or your kid's school or anything, because they might have, the workers might have coronavirus for being around these people who would have been, who were in Wuhan. And the county is saying, look, First of all, nobody from that original group that came from Wuhan has tested positive for coronavirus. There were two who got sick, they got tested, came back negative. So nobody in the group has it right now. Their quarantine ends tomorrow. But let alone the workers who have been wearing protective gear, been far away in many cases from those evacuees who came in. The county is saying to those who live there, don't exclude the healthcare workers and the base workers who have been trying to keep the evacuees safe from, don't keep them out of the community. They're not infecting the community. But apparently, not only is it those who are on the cruise ship in Japan, but even Americans working at March Air Reserve Base who are now getting ostracized and kicked out of their community for people who fear that they might have coronavirus and going to be spreading it.
Okay, so what I'd like to understand here, I just want to go back to the threat piece. The threat piece is coming from people in the community. It's coming externally. What do we know about that? Because it just sort of seems like a lot of what we're seeing on social media right now is ad hominem attacks by individuals who are eggs on Twitter, you know, that may not have any followers.
And who don't know anything about what they're talking about.
Right,
yeah.
And may just be sent by bots to go sort of, you know, go after people and, again, create more. And this is a tough situation already, but in order to create more fear and division and chaos here.
Yeah, and at least in the Riverside case, I don't know, and they said they don't have a real good idea of where it started yet, but it does seem like it is people in Riverside giving into the hysteria. You know, the people who are reading it online and going, you know what, you're darn right, I don't want them in my community.
Right.
And, you know, thinking that because these healthcare workers are in there taking care of the evacuees, clearly they probably have it too, and, you know, now their kids go to your school sort of thing. And then you get hysterical parents and others who are sharing it around and saying, yeah, I don't want them around my kids. And then it grows from there. But there's no truth to it. There's no background to it in any kind of truth other than just plain hysteria that the health department in Riverside County is saying, look, everybody calm down. Nobody's sick in the group. And so there's nothing that the healthcare workers could have gotten it from, let alone they were wearing the protective gear. They've been doing everything they need to do. That there's just nothing there.
Okay, so Alex Stone, we're talking to from ABC News. He's been covering this coronavirus outbreak from the West Coast perspective, which is obviously a lot of people are coming back in. There have been flights from China bringing people back in, as you just mentioned, to bases, to military bases on the West Coast for quarantine. I saw really what was a pretty alarming photograph yesterday from China of these makeshift hospitals that they've got. And China actually has a pretty sophisticated, especially in the big cities. And people must remember that Wuhan itself, that's a community of 11 million people. That's larger than the Chicago metropolitan area. So it's not some little backwater.
Yeah, or the city of New York or the city of L.A. I mean, that's a big city, not so much for China, but for the U.S.
Yes, exactly. Not for China, right. So it's a lot of people. But they were showing what this medical facility looked like. And it was like something out of a Michael Crichton, you know, book into a movie, right? I mean, it was very modern, but very sterile, and, you know, everybody, like even the patients themselves were totally covered, you know, and so the whole idea of being able to tap this down it's scary if you look at the pictures over there. And today, President Xi in China appeared at a hospital in Beijing, where there aren't many cases, but at a hospital in Beijing wearing a mask. And they're really upping the ante there in China. So we'll continue to watch this. Alex Stone, Stone Pony, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks, bro.
From ABC News. That is really... So this story does get wackier and, I mean, well, bigger and bigger. Let's put it that way. And weirder and wilder. And then you throw the social media piece on top of it and look out. All right, right now, Lauren Lapka standing by. She's got the traffic and the weather. Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. All right, let's check in with our man in Springfield. I've already taken you around the world today. We took you throughout Chicago. We took you out to California to find out about the coronavirus. And now we take you to Springfield because Springfield has got stupid things going on in it. And our man, Mark Maxwell, is standing by with Nextar Media.
That's a tongue twister. It'll get you.
Yeah, I know. I'm just coming off the weekend, pal. Don't expect too much from me. All right, let's talk.
Yeah.
Let us talk about the gambling plan in the state of Illinois. Now, this has come up a number of times on this program, and not because we are degenerate gamblers, just because I'm interested. The reality is that the state of Illinois, in the summer, passed legislation to make sports gambling legal in Illinois and expand casinos and sports gambling and all of that. To get, you know, they're adding casino licenses and they're adding sports gambling parlors, if you will, at sporting venues, stadiums, as well as at racetracks, and then those license holders also get an additional place to put a casino, like a sports book, a vet kind of place. And you see these now throughout the country. Even New Jersey's got them. Obviously, Las Vegas has had them for a long time. Nevada's had them for a long time. Okay, so Indiana now has them. And Indiana's up and going. As a matter of fact, if you watched the Oscars last night, you could have bet on it in Indiana. But you could not do it in Illinois, even though it's almost 9 months now, or 8 months, since Illinois passed the legislation. And as it turns out, Mark, you're about to tell us, Illinois doesn't even have a plan. They don't even have a coherent plan to move forward, even though they've been promising us that they have a coherent plan. What in the hell is going on?
Well, the gaming board is meeting regularly, and they put out those emergency rules. I think we spoke to you last when they had just put those out there. But, you know, we just passed the Super Bowl, right? And so there's some pressure and some anticipation from sports bettors who wonder, is this going to be up in the next 5 weeks in time for March Madness, which may be the other second biggest, you know, gambling event on the national sports calendar.
Which it is.
And it's fast approaching. It's almost here. The good news, if you're an optimist here, the gaming board has given these three temporary operating permits to a casino in Alton near St. Louis, and then Rivers in Des Plaines and the Grand Victoria in Elgin. So what that means is those three casinos can basically start breaking ground on their sports book. They have the sort of temporary yellow light, green light, whatever you want to call it, to say start, you know, putting some things in place. In fact, I think at least two of those three casinos are advertising job fairs. They're hiring people to staff these sports books, but they're just waiting for that final go-ahead, which could happen pretty quickly. Once that happens, the gaming board still has to test the machines and make sure that the actual devices work properly. We don't have an Iowa caucus event happening at the sports book ticket counter, but they do have some of those final procedures to go through. But yeah, when you zoom out and look at the, you know, the regional comparison, Indiana had a much faster rollout than Illinois. And so that does tend to make it creates a talking point for sure that Illinois is taking a lot more time. And it's a lot costlier to get into this game, too. If you're a casino, it's a lot more expensive here than in Indiana.
Right. And but here's we did a little bit of the numbers here. We looked at what happened. And Indiana basically was able, as soon as they put sports gambling up, sports gambling represented in its first number of months in operation, I think it's 5 months of operation for them, it represented about half of what the total amount for gambling was last year. So if you continue the casino gambling and you throw this on top, they'd be up 50-70%, depending on how you want to look at the number, from year to year in terms of their revenue, total state revenues for gambling. And Illinois still sitting on this. And the last time I checked, Mark, I don't know, maybe you've heard something different down in Springfield from your post there at Nextstar Media, and you're watching, you got like the big control tower down there looking at all the things that go on. Maybe you notice something different, but maybe the financial woes of the state of Illinois are completely fixed and finished, and maybe we shouldn't be worrying about this at all and the additional revenue that would be available to us. But something tells me that's not true, and it makes me nuts.
Not quite. In fact, the financial woes continue pretty significantly in Illinois. The gaming revenue, the gaming projections and the taxes will help, many of the, you know, budget experts tell us. But still, frankly, compared to the size of Illinois' fiscal woes, I hate to use the phrase drop in a bucket, but it's not going to do it on its own.
No, understood. But the thing is that it does two things. It is a few drops in the bucket, so that's okay. But it also, it puts us on par with other states that could be eating our lunch. And I just don't understand why the legislators, I know that, you know, listen, Illinois is all about guys there are a lot of guys down in Springfield who have their entire job is to pick from the tree of state government, and they pick the fruit and take off the rind and enjoy all the flesh and then plant the seeds of it. That was once described to me by a guy, an Illinois judge, who hears these cases and he's like, listen, these public corruption cases, they're all the same. And that's what it is. And there's a bunch of people down there that are willing to take advantage and try to cut corners and do things that they probably shouldn't be doing. Yes, we know that. In the meantime, though, are there not legislators who want to do the right thing? Are there not leaders I'm asking this, and I know the answer, but I'm asking it anyway. Are there leaders down there that don't actually want to get this thing done and make it legit? Because all these people who have these licenses, Mark, have already gone through all the process, right? Whether you have a racetrack or a casino or whatever it is, an ongoing gambling operation, you've already gone through the vetting. You've already gone through all of this. So what about before we add new ones, how about giving it to the people who already have them so that it gets going and the revenue starts coming in? I don't understand what the impediment is there.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because in Illinois, the only people who can have a sports book outside of a sports stadium directly are the casinos who are already up and running.
Right.
There are those other six new casinos that are coming to town. They're also being vetted. They're going through a pretty rigorous application process. So perhaps those six, if they chose to also roll out a sports book, would have some reasonable delay. But the other big difference, Ro, between Indiana and Illinois is that in Indiana, FanDuel and DraftKings were up and running basically automatically as soon as they rolled this out. And in Illinois, there's that 18-month penalty box where you have to walk into a brick-and-mortar casino to place your bet at a ticket window. It can't do it online either. So that's raised an interesting question of would one of these two companies, FanDuel or DraftKings, consider even buying a casino to get around that? Could they do that? There's a lot of interesting sort of speculation.
But there's other players. And I understand that market, but there's other players in that marketplace beside FanDuel and DraftKings.
Those are your household names.
Those are the two big ones. And they're in the penalty box for a reason. But there are other people who tried to come into that space, and there will be eventually more people in that space, right? Because those are so far pretty. But they're very successful, but they also set themselves up, right, with that just getting your kids. You and your kids are going to sit around the kitchen table and gamble with each other, right? Wasn't that the original idea? Oh, no, this is not for actual gambling. This is fantasy sports. We're doing fantasy here. Everybody loves fantasy. Hey, kids, come around the table. We're going to do fantasy. And then as soon as they were able to flip the switch to start actually taking in real money and then paying out real money on bets, then it changed for them. Well, the issue that we still are confronted with here is that there's a drag shoot up. There does appear to be a lack of movement in terms of getting any of this stuff done. And I don't think that we fully understand yet why. And when I don't understand why something is happening in Springfield, it is often because somebody is stealing. And I would like to just know who that is and why they're doing it.
Well, there are a couple other reasons, too, that you could add to the explanation. For example, the gaming board administrator and the director there, I mean, he's only been there for I'm going to say a couple months, 3-4 months. The staff there is pretty new. So you're asking this brand new staff to take on this really big task. They're not just rolling out sports gambling. They're also looking at these six new casino operators. They're also dealing with this administrative and legal headache of the feds breathing down the sweepstakes and the video gaming terminals and all of that.
Yes,
so
I understand.
They have a lot of work to do, and there are new staff.
But there are existing models that have been successful in other states. And I don't call New Jersey necessarily a clean state, by comparison. I mean, I consider that the unholy trinity to be Louisiana, Illinois, and New Jersey in the United States in terms of that sort of thing.
Pretty fair.
But there are other states that have been able to do this and move it out. And there are companies that are willing to, obviously to help. And there's publicly traded companies that are willing to help here, too. So, all right. Well, more to see. It's frustrating, and there's not enough, I don't think, communication with the stakeholders and also the people who want to be involved, the citizens who want to be involved in this. All right. Mark Maxwell, he's our man in Springfield. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob.
Mark Maxwell from Nexstar Media. All right, we have got news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming your way. And then Adam Hoge joins us. We're going to talk about what happened to football. And it's not a pretty story if you watch the XFL.
Radio Chicago. This is AM 720. WGN.
It's Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. Adam Hoge joins us right now. He's normally the Bears insider, but he knows a few things about the White Sox, too, because you hear him, you see him. He's a White Sox and Bears expert. And before we get to football, which I need to get to, and I know a lot of people think, well, what do you mean football? Football season's over. No, the football season started over again in what I consider to be a fairly awkward and embarrassing way with the introduction of the XFL. And we will talk a little bit about that. They had a full lineup this weekend of games on Saturday and Sunday and on big networks, too. Big networks. And I'm like, wait a second. Who are these guys? And I literally on the field, I was like, who are these guys? But before we do that, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, I want to ask you, because I just heard Kevin Powell. Are you familiar with him, by the way, Adam?
I am. Yeah, I've heard of him.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Kevin Powell was just mentioning in his sportscast about pitchers and catchers reporting in 2 days. Full squad workouts start a week from today, right?
Correct.
In Arizona. And this whole idea of pitchers and catchers reporting and the full squads being there on set dates, it's kind of antiquated, isn't it? I mean, these guys are all arriving now.
Yeah, I believe Tim Anderson's already been in Glendale for a week already. Most of those guys are already roaming around the facility. It's just it's that like the real programs get underway. The day-to-day grind and having like a set schedule all day. But most of these guys are already there working out, and especially with the excitement of the White Sox right now, I think that those players specifically, they're gearing up and ready to go.
Do you feel as though there is optimism on the north side, which would not be the north side of of Scottsdale or of Tempe, but do you think it's funny? All I hear is talk about the White Sox and excitement about the White Sox, and it sounds to me a little bit like the Cubs are still trying to find their way through. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, they just haven't done much this offseason, so it's hard to really be excited about a team that hasn't really added anything, and you know, the whole story all offseason has been this arbitration case with Chris Bryant. And so that finally got resolved, but there's still rumors and talks that they're going to trade him. And that would make it, if they were to trade Chris Bryant, then this would be a team that would definitely be worse than they were last year. And last year they fell well short of expectations. And it's hard to see how they're any better whatsoever right now. And so you could see why these two teams in Chicago seem to be going in different directions.
Well, there's no question that the White Sox, the excitement around the White Sox organization is palpable. And even the media excitement around them. And you know, the White Sox, White Sox fans, have, I think, for a long time, justifiably complained about their treatment in the media, that they're always the second story, even if they have a better record at any given moment than the Cubs have had over the last, number of decades. But this now, I think, because of their status as the most improved team in baseball year over year in terms of their roster, right? I mean, I don't think there's any argument about that. That's what almost every national sports organization is saying about them. And they've got this young, like, just crazy murderer's row of offensive weapons. It's going to be, no matter how you slice it, it's going to be a very fun year on the South Side.
Yeah, I think so. And I think especially when you consider this blend of the young talent that is finally here, finally arrived with a couple pieces that are probably still on the way, if not by opening day, a month or two into the season, like a Nick Madrigal, for instance, who may end up being this team's leadoff hitter when they finally get their full lineup together to make a run at the World Series.
And starting second baseman.
Correctly. Yeah, so that's why there's so much excitement. Then you throw in guys like Edwin Encarnacion and Dallas Keuchel, the veterans that they threw into the mix, and it does seem like they're coming together. And I think, I've liked to compare this upcoming season a lot to what the Cubs did in 2015, which was the year before they won the World Series. But thinking back on it, the Cubs, I would say, almost snuck up on us a little bit more that year than the White Sox would at this point. There seems to be even more hype about this White Sox team right now at this point, it only being February 10th. And I don't necessarily believe they're going to win the World Series this year, but I do think they're going to be right there in the mix, especially in a division that, you know, other than the Twins, I think the White Sox are the second best team.
Yeah. Twins are tough, though. And
they are.
Then Twins did not get worse. So that I think is...
No, they hit 300 home runs last year and added Josh Donaldson. So
Can I ask you a question, though? There was some talk in the offseason here that there was going to be a little look-see at the ball, at what's what has happened to the baseball. Because there's a lot of conspiracy theories. A lot of people have thoughts. Adam Hogue, White Sox and Bears insider, that there might have been some juicing of the ball. If not the players, the ball. I also happen to think there's some juicing of the players, but that's a separate issue. We'll get to that. Eventually, science will catch up with something. But what do you make of that? Is the ball too hot?
Well, it's a tough question because no one's been able to prove it either way. I think the best example that's been given is that it might not necessarily be something that they're intentionally, you know, putting into the ball as much as it just might be a small difference in the way they're making it. I don't know if you buy that or not, but there's been a ton of home runs. Look, the problem is right now in baseball, I'd like to make it a bigger picture discussion, because the integrity, whether you're talking about the steroid era or now this you know, these examples of cheating with pitch tipping and going to, you know, clearly illegal lengths to find out which pitches are coming, which to me is actually way worse than even just juicing.
Yeah.
Because sure. If you know what's
active
coming,
cheating.
It is, because if you know what's coming, you can hit it. If you're taking steroids, you can still strike out. You know what I mean? You can still miss the ball.
Sammy Sosa proved that to us. Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. So, I mean, the point overall is the more and more questions there are about this kind of stuff, it's hard to explain the baseball right now. I honestly don't know where I fall on it, I believe there's anything going on or not, but no one seems to be able to explain it.
I like the conspiracy of it. Although, I got to tell you something. Just say, yeah, we juice the baseball because we want more home runs. Fine, because people love home runs. There's nothing wrong with that. Just the pitchers are going to have to recalibrate their contracts. All right, we'll come back. We'll talk about the XFL. I did not understand anything that I saw this weekend in XFL games. Perhaps you can explain it to me, but we'll take some phone calls on it as well. But first, let's check in with Lauren Lapko. What's happening on the roads and in the skies? All right, can we talk about what the hell was that on television this week with the XFL? First of all, explain this. How many teams are there in the XFL?
There's eight.
Eight. How many were there? What was the thing last year that closed shop? What was the name of that thing?
The AAF.
The AAF, right. Okay.
Yeah.
And that had like eight teams in it.
I think it had eight teams as well.
Yeah, but they were in poop kicker towns, though, mostly. These are in big cities. Like, I watch, you know, there's like Los Angeles and Seattle and Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Have teams. We're the only ones without a franchise at the moment, like kind of the major cities here. New York's got one, right?
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, in L.A.
Yep. Yeah. So I'm watching the game between the Washingtons. I always like to make this joke when I talk about teams that have well-known names, and I pretend I don't know the names. In this case, I'm not pretending. I have no idea. The Washingtons and the Seattles. One had like a snake or something on its helmet, and the other one, I couldn't even understand what it was. And they were playing this game in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, what appeared to be at a soccer stadium. Or a really large high school stadium. Do we know even what that was? Who are these people, and who are the people on the field?
Well, I do believe that was at Audi Field, which is where the DC United soccer team plays, which I like the idea of putting these games in smaller venues, because if you caught any of the New York game yesterday, they were playing at MetLife Stadium where the Jets and Giants play. Mm-hmm. The place just looked like an empty, you know,
yes.
just giant empty place, and right. It just didn't look great at all.
I said there were 16,000 or something in D.C. for that game.
Yeah. Like yeah. So here's a couple things I am skeptical of first off. One thing is I caught a little bit of all four games this weekend, didn't watch any of them in full, but when I did tune in, I kept hearing the broadcasters talk about how they were pleased with the quality of play. Every time I tuned in, though, I kept seeing bad play. So it felt like they were trying to sell that to us.
They're in the tank. They're in the tank.
These are all NFL rejects. Let's be honest. These are all basically players like there's a player named Willie Beavers who was an offensive lineman on the Bears practice squad a year ago. Okay, and he's one of the random names that resurfaced this weekend. So these guys are all players that have failed trying to make it into the NFL, which is fine. They're getting paid to play the game they love. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm not really buying the talent altogether, and I didn't really like how they were playing in bigger stadiums. Some of them were. I'd much rather these play, like if the Dallas team was playing in the Texas Rangers Stadium, which also I thought was a little weird because that's a baseball stadium. But
yeah, but I like it when they have to play in a baseball field because I like when they have to run across the dirt then back into the grass. It reminds me of Oakland back in the day. I really like it. But what's the future for this? I mean,
yeah,
they're capitalized, right? They've got real money investors behind
it. Yeah, because Vince McMahon's behind this, and he's the same one that came up with the XFL back in, I think that was 2000, and it failed. But the thinking here is they learn from those mistakes, and they're going to fix it. I think the one thing that they got going for them are the TV contracts. Because as you mentioned, Ro, I mean, these games were played on Fox and ABC and ESPN this weekend. I believe the original XFL was on NBC, but that was a long time ago. This landscape of sports television has changed. The difference with the AAF last year is I remember a lot of those games being on like CBS Sports Network,
right,
which is a channel that you may have, but you might not even know you have it, or you certainly don't remember what channel it is when you're trying to find that game. So I do think having especially ESPN behind this league is something that could help it survive. I would
you
like
mean for
to
the
see-
season, unlike last year where they actually right. closed down before the end of the season.
But here's what I would like to see, and this would take a lot of work with the NFL Players Association, but to me it would be way more interesting if you had players like that were currently on the Bears practice squad or like at the back end of their 90-man roster in the offseason. Like say you're allowed to send 10 players, developmental players that didn't play for you, were basically on the practice squad and could use the reps, send them into this league in the offseason to get them real reps. That would be not only make the league more competitive, but also would make the interest. And I'm not saying like the most casual fan would care, but there's a lot of diehard Bears fans that actually do pay attention to like Ryan Nall, who's been in camp and a running back for the last 2 years for the Bears and is still technically on the team. That would, I think, help the draw and help the league survive.
That's a tall order, though, because there's a lot of different factors. As you mentioned, you got union contracts. It would take the NFL embracing this,
yeah,
and deciding that it wants to make this the developmental league for the NFL. But you already have NCAA, which is the developmental league for the NFL, and it's really interesting because you saw there were some names I saw playing of guys who were maybe college standouts. And then didn't fare too well in the NFL, and that 4, 5, 6 years ago, and now all of a sudden they're popping up, and it's like there's just football is such a unique enterprise to America. It is not a well received sport around the world, even though the NFL has really been trying to make it, with NFL Europe and obviously with taking these games and playing them in London and Mexico City and all those kinds of things. I just don't think it's ever really, really going to totally take off, even in Canada, right? Which has a lot of cultural similarities to the United States. Even in Canada, they've had trouble really selling the concept of football. It's okay football being played there, but you got to remember what you just said is that these are people that didn't make the NFL. These are people that also didn't make the CFL, right? Because the CFL pays better than the XFL would. So you're really at the bottom of whatever it is. And I noticed that one of the things that they were doing, and again, obviously these television networks, CBS, Fox, and ESPN. They don't want to lose money on these deals. They want to pique your interest. So I've noticed that they've shaved some information here, which is like, where do these guys go to college? Where do I know that guy from? What is it? They're trying to sort of make them almost into video game stars. This is X-Man from the XFL, and I the whole thing feels very very weird to me because Cardell Jones, right, was the Ohio State quarterback. Right from a few years ago, he was the quarterback of one of these teams, and I'm going, where do I know? And I'm a huge Ohio State fan, and it took me probably a set of downs before I was like, oh, that's him!
Yeah.
What is he doing here?
Yep, but he didn't make it in the NFL, so this is where he is. Matt McGloin played at Penn State. He was playing in a game. They're making a big deal about this guy, Philip Nelson, who 6 months ago was an underwear model. That was a real story before one of these games. And I'm like, where do I know that name from? He played at Minnesota, of course. So, yeah, there's a bunch of these random names that kept popping up. But let me give you, again, two things that I did like. One, the TV presentation was pretty cool. I'm struggling because I still don't know these names, and I'm trying to figure out why should I care about these names, right, and these players.
Yeah.
But the presentation, be able to hear the coaches call plays.
Oh,
like they were tapping into the headsets of the coaches, so you could hear them call the plays.
Which was hysterical, because the coaches were still covering their mouths while they were calling the plays. But the play is being called, and I don't know if that's a great idea or not a great – to me, that's like the Belichick rule, right? Oh, we get to hear them. Oh, great. This makes cheating even easier. But there was also something that I thought they did interestingly, and I got about 40 seconds left.
Sure.
I want to talk about the kickoff.
Yes.
Because I like the idea of how they're doing the kickoff here, where the kicker is back at the 35-yard line kicking the ball, but the line is up about, what, 15 yards off of where the receiver is, or 20 yards off where the receiver is, and they only have 10 yards before the blockers. I noticed that, so it slows up the impact.
Right, it makes it more similar to like a play at the line of scrimmage.
Yeah.
And I quickly, because I know we're short on time, I honest to God think this was the biggest story of the weekend, because I think it saved the kickoff in the NFL. I don't know if we're going to see it this year or 2 years from, 2 years from now, but the kickoff was going to disappear eventually. This may save it, because it made it both interesting and safer.
Yes, it was interesting. And actually, the returns are a little bit bigger, actually.
Yeah, you can get a return out of it.
All right. Well, more to come. Or not. We'll fail to find out. My guess is this one doesn't make the whole season either, but we'll just happen to see. I wish everybody the best of luck. Do we work for any of those companies? Oh, I think I do. Okay. I hope this thing works great. All right. Thank you very much.
Adam Holmes. See you guys.
All right. Football and Baseball Insider for us. We've got the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming your way in 2 minutes.
WGN in the morning with Bob Surratt. Everything you wanted to know about getting your new Real ID driver's license direct from Secretary of State Jesse White after the 8:30 news.
Radio Chicago, WGN. Rob Khan Show, right here on 720 WGN. All right. Remember a couple of months ago, we started talking about this. There are these signals that are coming from outer space toward Earth, radio signals, that not exactly been fully identified or defined. But there's been a couple of different organizations that have stopped and thought, okay, well, you know, or stated that, well, this might just be a naturally occurring phenomenon. We're not exactly sure that this is anything mysterious. This just could be the way that that outer space works, and other mysteries that we don't completely fully understand. But now, science is taking a little different look at this, which is pretty interesting. As it turns out, that these FRBs, fast radio bursts, as they are known, may have a regular cycle to them. And as that regular cycle continues, it is coming to the attention of some scientists that this might actually be something that, might be a beacon of some sort from somewhere else that is coming back at us. Dr. Seth Shostak is with us. He's a senior astronomer at SETI, which is that organization you see in all the movies where they're looking for life outside of our solar system. And I got to ask you, Doctor, this as I was reading the story about this, and specifically the really what appears to be a pretty precise regular appearance by these deep space signals, it's got to get you wondering, right?
Well, it certainly is intriguing. I'll give you that. Although I'm not ready to credit the aliens for producing it yet.
Well, what else could it be?
Well, as you point out, this particular fast radio burst, and we know of dozens of these things, right? Most of them were seen once and never seen again. You know, sort of like the ghost in your attic. You see it once, but you don't see it again. If you only see it once, it's very hard to learn much about it because you can't, you know, go wrestle some bigger telescopes in and have them look at it, you know, because you don't know if you'll ever see it again, so you just can't do that. But this one does repeat. It repeats, as you say, every 16 days. Not exactly 16 days, 16 and a third day, something like that.
Yeah.
And then for about 4 days, every 16 days, it does its thing. And it sends out these radio bursts, and then, you know, it's quiet for the next 12 days, and then again, does it all again. Now, you could say, oh, well, that sounds like aliens. I mean, I don't know why it sounds like aliens, except that, you know, they obviously have a broadcast schedule, if it really is them. But it does sound like something that involves an object in an orbit, because those are also regular.
So, we'll explain that. So, an orbit is a mathematical reality, right? So, the idea here is that an orbit would take a defined period of time, and if an orbit is a standard circular orbit, or even I suppose elliptical orbit, it would be at least regular in terms of what it's sending out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's sending out a signal, it would be predictable in that way. So, could that be from the energy of something orbiting something else in deep space?
Yeah, whatever it is.
Well, what could that be? No, I mean, I don't want to take the aliens off the table here, but what else? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out. Do you see other things in space as you guys are out there? I mean, obviously, you've got all these telescopes and radio telescopes that are looking, you know, out into space and trying to figure out if there's anything out there or deep, deep, deep out there. There are mysteries still, you know. We know a lot less than we know about space, right? So the question is, what other explanations could there be?
Well, let me just say, as a general comment, almost every time in the past 30 or 40 years that astronomers, particularly radio astronomers, have found something new in the sky, which after all is their job description. You go out there and find something new. We're not interested in you finding something that's already known. That we're not going to pay you for that. So every time they find something new, there's always going to be some group of people, some small group who think, this is really mysterious. This could be aliens trying to get in touch, which it could be, but it so far never has been. Now,
I think we're about to change that, Doctor. I don't know.
I do too. I mean, that's my job here. But on the other hand, look, if for example, if you happen to be, I don't know, in nearby space, and every time the Earth went around in its orbit, which takes about 365 days.
So last time I checked,
Most people know that. And it gets, you know, it does something. For example, I don't know, there's a New Year's Eve celebration or something, and you notice this thing, and it's occurring every 365 days. You could say, well, that must mean something. Well, yeah, it's tied to the orbit of the Earth around the sun. So this is happening every 16 days, whatever it is. And it could be, 16 days is a very short period for anything to go around anything else. But if you were some sort of bizarre object, you know, I don't know, a neutron star, a strange star, even a big planet, and you were going around a black hole, you could very easily go around that black hole every 16 days. And maybe every 16 days, you get hit by a cloud of material being burped out of the black hole. I'm not suggesting this is the explanation here. All I'm saying is the fact that it's every 16 days is not a good clue to it being done by aliens.
Hold on, listen, you
might not buy that. You know, you might say, oh, he's just being disingenuous because, I don't know, somebody's paying him off to tell us that it's
No. I'm not one of those nuts. I'm nuts, but I'm not one of those nuts, Dr. Shostak from SETI. I just happen to think that there's that it's interesting. I think we're getting closer and closer and closer to realizing, for a lot of different reasons, whether we actually contact other sentient beings somewhere in our lifetime. I mean, that's, I still think, a crapshoot. But I think every day we get closer and closer and closer to realizing that there are habitable, as we understand them, habitable worlds out there. that are around similar solar systems to ours. And you know, the deeper we can look and the deeper we see, we realize that there may be some similarities. So
yeah, absolutely. I bet everybody a cup of Starbucks will find something within 20 years. So I may have to buy a lot of coffee. But in this case, keep in mind that these FRBs have been found not just in this particular case where they were traced to a galaxy that's 500 million light years away.
Yeah, it's
that's a long way. That's a long way. Yeah. But there are other FRBs and galaxies in a completely different direction that are 3 billion light years away. So how is it that these aliens have arranged for everybody to do the same thing for billions of years?
I think we're just in the lost part. I think we're like in the South Pacific right now. We're just a little lost. All right. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it as always. Dr. Seth Shostak from SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. All right. Let us now talk to Lauren Lapka as we search for the traffic and the weather. There's a bill. I'm sorry to have that moment where I had a thoughtful pause, but I just do not understand why this bill is being introduced. In Springfield, there is a lawmaker who would like to ban pumping of your own gas starting next year.
Don't knock it, because even though I felt weird when I moved to Oregon that that's how it is out there, and I was going to be, I freaked out when I went to the gas station for the first time, I became so accustomed to it, and it's so nice, especially, think about in Chicago, you don't have to get out of your car when it's freezing cold.
You almost said a swear, didn't you?
No.
You almost did. I could tell. You were stopping, yeah?
You know how long I've been doing this? I'm trained. My brain is trained not to even think of swears.
No, I don't think that's true.
I'm just so happy they're addressing the pressing issues in the state.
Yes, exactly. Now, if passed, the bill would create the Gas Station Attendant Act. It states that no gas may be pumped at a gas station in Illinois unless it is pumped by a professional attendant. And by the way, I'm old enough to remember when you'd pull into a gas station and you couldn't pump your own gas in Illinois. And then eventually we did get self-serve. And there's a couple gas stations. I was just at one today. There's a gas station that I go to get a car wash all the time that's got a section that you pull into, and it's got half the pumps are attendant pumping. And the funny thing is, people pull in, the attendant comes out, and then if you just sat there and you watched this for like an hour, you'd see the same thing happen. Guy pulls in, woman pulls in, whatever it is. Attendant comes out and goes, "Wait, you know, what can I do?" And they go, "No, this is attendant only." And then they immediately back out awkwardly and try to get to the self-pump pumps. Because do we want to pay extra? First of all, you know, we end up paying a lot of money for the gasoline, even in a situation, especially in Illinois, in a situation where if you were almost in any other state, I mean, I paid $3.40 or something today for gas, and I got the mid-level. I got the half fancy gas. I don't even know why. I'm not even sure what that does for me, but it just made me feel better. It was only 20 cents more, and I only needed a couple of gallons. So I thought, I'll just throw that in there and see if I can up the octane. I don't even know I don't even know what that does. But I did notice that that's still a lot of money. But you're almost anywhere else. Every time I travel outside the state, I'm paying a lot less money for gas. And now we're going to throw an attendant on top of that, which is going to add to the cost?
I'm all for it. If I don't have to pump my own gas, that would be awesome. But why are they doing this is the question. And my guess would be for some sort of tax reason, because they're going to throw a tax on top of it somehow, because it's the state of Illinois. Why else would they be doing this?
It must be it. All right, so now, didn't Oregon just take this off the books, though, Lauren?
Not that I've seen.
I think they did.
I know some...
You can legally pump your own gas now in Oregon.
I know some counties you can, based on population. It will be like populations lower than 50,000, so it's really small town areas.
All right. I still don't. I get it. I'm old enough to remember when you just had to, you know, you pulled in, and I'm sitting in the back of my parents, and they would tell them to do something. There were like four people to run around the car and do things. They'd be like washing your window and hey, can I check your oil? You know, and it's, which means something totally different now. And they would like lift up the whole deal, and they would be in there, and they'd be tinkering around, and they go, "Oh, you're down a few quarts," you know. But now everything's computerized. You're literally, your car calls your phone and tells you there's a problem. Right. I mean, this is the need for that kind of full servicey thing is over. Shall I check your tire, sir? I mean, that's that. No one's got time for that. People just want to pull in. They won't pull out. I just this makes almost zero sense to me.
I mean, for local gas stations, this is going to cost them money. You figure, I mean, the BP gas station downtown, like in River North, has got to be one of the busiest gas stations in the country. Every time I pull in there, I'm driving around just to find a pump available. How are they going to service that many cars on a daily basis? You're going to have full service staff to just fill gas?
And the funny part of that, there's always a guy who's willing to pump your gas over there.
Right. He's asking for a small fee.
I'll pop your gas! And you're like, no, that's okay. No, I'm going to do it! You go, no, it's fine. No! And then I'm like, okay, please don't hurt me. And then I drive away. Like, even if I'm on fumes, I'm like, I think I've got to leave now. And actually, that gas station you just identified also in the summer happens to have like road rallies every weekend, unintentionally, by the way. This is not something they like. But like all the motorcycle, you know, guys, the guys on the Rice Rockets that like to make noise downtown and chase each other because they know the police aren't going to stop them. And there's like 50 of them at a time, and they pull into the parking lot and take up everything anyway. I mean, I don't know. Does it make it safer? Does it make it better? Does it make it more convenient? I love the idea of just pulling in and not having to worry about anything and get out when it's cold. But if it's going to cost me more money, to me, it's like extra steps. You know, I'm getting out. I'm doing a curl by pulling out the pump. I'm doing a little math, right, by pressing the buttons and trying to remember my zip code. I mean, there are things. And then that's the other deal. You're going to hand them the credit card. They're going to need to know all the stuff about you.
All they need to know was the zip code every time I've had to do that.
Yeah, but I don't want them knowing my zip code.
What? It's probably business. Wherever you're getting the gas.
No, but it's not. It's not. And I don't want, the zip code, that's an identifier for your credit card.
Well, wouldn't you have to give them your PIN number?
No.
On a debit card.
They run it as credit. They run everything as credit.
Yeah,
I don't know about that because they ask you if it's a debit card. Like they have the little.
They would not ask you for a PIN. Trust me.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
Did they not?
I'm guessing back in the day, it was like somebody just rolled down the window and handed him like a $10 bill. Okay, fill it up.
Right.
Nobody
or a personal check. I think they used to hand you. And then if you did it on a credit card, they had a thing where they would slide the credit card and then they'd put it on a little plastic thing. I mean, to get gas, it was like an hour-long procedure to get gas when there was a guy pumping the gas. And it was like they had a conversation with you about things. You know, how are the kids? You know, it's like, what are you doing?
Definitely not like that these days.
I don't know.
So did you ever run into, because you lived in Oregon where they have this, did you ever run into a situation where you went to a gas station that was like, let's just say completely full, every pump was going, every spot was filled? How many attendants were there running around filling cars?
2 to 3.
So how long did you have to wait?
Not very long. They're really good about seeing who comes in, what order, who should be addressed next. Because really, they just get your stuff, most likely a credit card. Okay, zip code. They'll start you, and then they'll run to everybody else. It's not like they wait for your whole car to finish.
That's rude.
No, they're good. They're on top of it.
I mean, this is all going to benefit state of Illinois politicians somehow, obviously.
Yeah,
somebody's
be.
Behind this.
Yeah, there must be somebody who's got a cousin that can't get employed to, like, this will be a good idea. So people always pump gas. What are you gonna do? Pump gas when you grow up? Yeah. All right. We got you a job. Okay. All right.
I'm skeptical of this.
Oh, skeptical. I mean, this is like I know, but Lauren is like a she's an optimist about these kinds of things. She likes the idea that, but what's old is new again, right? It's sort of like this idea that we already went through this. There was a reason we got rid of it in the first place. And now we got to start all over again. I don't know. I got a good feeling about this. All right, we've got a top 5 of 5 coming your way on the other side, and then Mr. Roper is going to be here in the 6 o'clock hour to discuss what happened at the Oscars last night. And I don't understand it because it wasn't in Korea.
It's the top 5 on the Rokan Show.
5.
Let's go.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Now, it's the top 5 at 5 on the Rokan Show, sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
If we must. Checking in at
number 5.
Number of people killed by the coronavirus in China continues to rise. Officials reporting now a total of 908 deaths. And that makes it more deadly than the SARS outbreak, which was the previous really scary thing that happened there. And now there are 12 cases that have been confirmed. 6 more people aboard a cruise ship quarantined in Japan. I should say that 12 more in the United States have been confirmed. And then you've got Americans on this cruise ship that is docked off of the Japanese coast right now. They've tested positive for the virus, bringing the total on this particular cruise ship of people with the virus to 70. One of the six patients is a woman in her 70s who has a Hong Kong residency, but also a U.S. citizen. And therefore, the U.S. passengers now on that ship, 14 of them have the coronavirus. 75-year-old Gay Quarter, who was aboard the vessel, told the Today Show that not everybody's infected, so they should be allowed to leave.
The only test we've received has been one thermometer check a week ago. For 30 seconds, we all need to be tested. At least do the Americans on board. Our government needs to step up. It's time to come for us now. We are definitely not safe on this ship, and we need to be evacuated while some of us are still healthy.
Oh, imagine that, man. This is like the Poseidon Adventure without the ship turning over. I mean, I've never understood the cruise. Ever. On those gigantic cruise ships that look like, you know, floating cities and floating high rises, because there's people. I'm telling you, man, people. You know, they're going to the all you can eat buffet, and they're touching stuff and sneezing on things, and the whole thing's wrong. And now you're on that boat, and you got to go. I mean, they're not coming to give you dinner in your room at night, right? Because they can't, because they got the people with the coronavirus. They got to take care of those people. And there's people touching the people who did that. I mean, I'm telling you, as a hypochondriac, this is the worst possible imaginable situation. And all the rest of you hypochondriacs out there know exactly what I'm talking about. So the most amazing thing about this, though, is that people on board this has become sort of like the ghost ship of the Sea of Japan, this particular vessel. Because there are Americans on board who've been on social media saying, hey, we're stuck here. We want to come home. And then there's other Americans who are emailing or you know, on social media responding to them and saying, no, if you come home, we'll kill you. I mean, these people are getting death threats for trying to get off the boat. That's how stupid all this is. Now, I happen to believe, without any evidence, but then again, who needs evidence anymore before saying things? It's very popular. That this also is a part of the whole internet trolling world. I'm sure that there's some internet research agency kind of place that has set up these bots to look for people who are in desperate situations and then just jump on them. Which, again, dismisses any hope that the individual can have in humanity when they read that on their own social media feed. And I think that's the intention of it. But back to the reality of this, what do you do with them? Because this woman, she's right, well, she's not sick yet, but who knows what she's been exposed to, and it turns out, and that's the issue, that it looks like it's up to a two-week incubation period for this particular virus, and you are contagious before you present the symptoms. Oh, man. I don't know.
That's a nightmare situation, being stuck on a cruise like that.
I think I'm going to just try to swim home. You know, like sneak into the lifeboat and like lower it down, you know, kind of like Titanic style. I don't know.
Is anybody here genuinely actually worried about getting the coronavirus?
No.
Like the chances of me getting it are next to zero. The chances of me dying from it are next to zero. Now, with me saying all of that, I'm probably going to get the coronavirus and die from it.
Nice. It was nice knowing you,
yeah,
Kevin.
I had a good run.
Thank you. Yeah.
But there's so much hysteria over it, and social media goes nuts about it, and people make jokes, and there's memes. It's a cycle we've seen a million times.
Yeah. The only problem is it's not burning out quickly. Like, you know, SARS, by this point in the SARS epidemic, SARS was already starting to take care of itself. It's already starting not to move. And again, it is up to the, you know, the government agencies in the regions of which are most affected by this, to be able to step in and do all of the kinds of mechanisms that are available to them, sociological mechanisms that are available to them to keep people from coming into contact with each other and keep infected people from coming into contact with uninfected people. But, and you're seeing that in China, but it's not particularly effective. And we've not had a significant outbreak here yet. And actually, it really hasn't left China, which is good because they basically shut down the Wuhan province in terms of people coming or going. But you got cases here in the United States. And then, of course, you know, there's six in California and one in Wisconsin, two here, one in Massachusetts, Arizona. I mean, they're everywhere in places essentially where there has been a lot of travel, right? So international airport kind of destinations. All right. I don't feel good. I got to get on an airplane this week, though. I'm not going to breathe. I got to get on two airplanes, and I've decided that four, I guess, two going down, two coming back. I'm going to bring my own oxygen. Now, there was a guy who got thrown off an airplane, right? If you bring your own parachute, that's frowned upon. You bring your own crash helmet, that's frowned upon. If you bring your own oxygen, is that frowned upon? All right, let's check in now with Lauren Lapka. We'll get to your 4-3-2-1. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Kevin was just talking about how healthy he is, and that must be
I'm feeling healthy. That's why I'm not worried about
you're not worried about the coronavirus now because you got the probiotics going. Yeah, I got that going. No big deal. Yeah, it seems. By the way, I just got an alert just popped on my phone. It said over 1,000 people now have perished from the coronavirus. Just when I wasn't getting nervous, I'm getting nervous now all over again. All right, we continue on, though, with the top 5 of 5. We worked our way up to
number 4.
Head of the New Hampshire primary, the race seems to be coming down to Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. Now, Pete Buttigieg is changing his campaign strategy slightly here. He is out telling former Republicans that he's their guy, that he would be the right answer. You know, Bernie is a socialist and he's the guy. If you want a moderate fiscal conservative, he is the man for you. And he was in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and says that when it comes to Bernie Sanders' math, it just doesn't add up.
I know that that creates a sense of exhaustion that may tempt some of us to turn it off and walk away altogether. $25 trillion worth of revenue. A lot of it coming from areas that we could agree on. I think we all agree that the wealthy and corporations need to pay their fair share. I have a harder time agreeing with the idea of raising taxes on the middle class.
I didn't say that. I said what we were going to do was we were going to raise taxes on everybody except for me and my wife. Because she does my taxes and she handles the whole thing. It's so funny to watch Larry David's impression. He was again on Saturday Night Live over the weekend doing Bernie Sanders, because now I cannot look at Bernie Sanders and not see the exact same misanthrope. They're like one and the same. So if you watch Curb, it's like that's Bernie Sanders. Now, would you like to hear from Bernie Sanders? Here he is in Ringe, New Hampshire. And by the way, New Hampshire needs to get some better names for their towns. What's it, Knoxville? What's the name of the notch that we got to go to tonight at midnight? Dixville Notch? First of all, okay. All right, let's just stop there. Nobody in Dixville figured it out, right? There wasn't like a town council in Dixville that said, hey, you know what? What's wrong with North Boston? Really? Dixville? So it turns out, by the way, Dixville Notch is the first place to vote in New Hampshire. They open at midnight, and then there's like 9 residents that vote there. And it turns out now that 8 of those residents don't live in Dixville anymore, which, again, is good because, I mean, who wants that as your return address? Here he is, Bernie Sanders explaining himself.
On Saturday, I am told by our campaign director, if you can believe it, in one day, we knocked on 20% of the doors in the state of New Hampshire. That's pretty good. Because you stood up for justice, we won 22 states last time around and helped transform the conversation of where America should be going.
Okay, yeah, that's right. But you couldn't be president. See, that's the problem, Bernie, my friend. You got no shot. You are certainly the guy that Donald Trump can beat. And the question is, for Democrats, do they want to send a guy up to just get slaughtered by Donald Trump? Or do they want to have a competitive candidate? Now, I don't happen to look at much of that field and think to myself that there's a whole lot of competitive candidates in it. I'll be honest. I mean, Joe Biden, everybody thinks is a competitive candidate until you start watching Joe Biden for like more than 5 minutes. And you're like, I don't know. There's something good. I don't know. I mean, he's got a resume, right? We know who he is. I mean, familiar with him and all that. But you're just kind of watching him and like, I don't even, you know, forget about Rudy Giuliani trying to dig up dirt. That's got nothing on the fact that Jolton Joe just doesn't seem all that interested in it. And they got Elizabeth Warren, who's like Bernie Light, there's just been too many people. Pete Buttigieg seems like the only person who's got a pulse right now. But we will see. And then in New Hampshire, like anything counts. But I'll tell you, the guy to look out for here is Bloomberg, because he's going to spend a poop load of money to try to get your vote here in Illinois.
Number three.
That's Elton John, Sir Elton John, from the Oscars last night. He and his songwriting partner, Bernie Taupin, won for Best Original Song. It was their first award, major award they ever won together. Won the Golden Globe for the same thing this year. But now you think about that. They've been writing together for 53 years. 53 years. And think about all of the songs, the Elton John songs in the last 53 years. And the only time that Elton John had won an Oscar, a major award, with a writing partner was for his work at Disney, and that was not Bernie Taupin's lyrics. So after 53 years and thousands upon thousands of songs, they finally won a major award together. And backstage, he talked about how this has been a long time coming.
This is for him. This is for my partner of 53 years. Without him, I wouldn't be here. He starts the process. He gives me the lyrics. Then I go ahead. Without the lyrics, I'm nobody. When you work on something for 12 years as a team and you work really hard and it comes out the way you want it to, this is a nice affirmation.
Yeah. That was a nice moment last night, I thought, at the Oscars. And then the rest of the time, it was the only award last night that Parasite did not win. We'll be discussing that with Richard Roper, because I have thoughts about that, my friends. It's a fine film, but should not have won Best Picture. But we'll get to that a little bit later on. In the meantime, we've worked our way all the way to, don't tell me, it's this one. Here it is.
Number two.
That's the one. Amazon's founder Jeff Bezos received some playful jabs at the Oscars last night by Steve Martin and Chris Rock. They called him out for his wealth and his recent divorce settlement. let's face it. If you're going to take a target, pick a target in the audience, might as well go for the biggest guy.
Jeff Bezos is here.
Oh!
Jeff Bezos.
Wow, great actor.
Hey, he's got cash. When he writes a check, the bank bounces. Jeff Bezos is so rich, he got divorced, and he's still the richest man in the world. He saw Marriage Story and thought it was a comedy. Steve, do you have anything you want to add about Mr. Bezos?
No, I like getting my packages on time.
Now, the funny thing about this is that you had those guys come out, right? And then you had, was it Kristen Wiig, right? Who was it? And Kristen Wiig and
Maya Rudolph.
Maya Rudolph. Yes, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate your help. And that was all really funny. So, I mean, now why don't you spread the risk of being the Oscars host? Right? I mean, it's obviously too risky for an individual to become the Oscars host, because that's going to ruin their life, ruin their career. They're going to get canceled for something they said, or the way that they looked at somebody, or an incident where they didn't bow to somebody when they walked by, whatever it's going to be. So now, what if you do like team hosting, right? Maybe you get 8 people. You get your Will Ferrell. He was very funny last night too. You get 8 different funny interesting, talented people from Hollywood, and then you spread them out. And if somebody happens to screw up during the telecast, you take them out in the parking lot and you shoot them. I mean, that just proves to the whole, like, you know, canceled community. Yes, we took care of business. Sorry, Chris Rock. Shouldn't have done that. Bad tweet. All right. Finally.
Number one.
Robert Conrad, the actor best known for his role in Black Sheep Squadron, the 70s television series, also in the Wild Wild West, has died. Born in Chicago in 1935, he moved to L.A. in 1958, found almost instant success. He had a recurring role on the TV show Hawaiian Eye in 1959. He scored his signature role, that of Secret Service agent James West in Wild Wild West.
For some reason, bathing invariably gives me an appetite.
It often has the same effect on me.
Wonderful, then we can have dinner tonight. We can share a finger bowl.
Hardly. We haven't been properly introduced.
And then he went on to a series of other roles along the way, always just a consistent television character, television face throughout the 60s into the 70s, and then Ba-Ba Black Sheep.
Hey, Tommy.
I'm in a tree over your head, Boyington.
There isn't any tree over my head. Tommy, I got you.
Then how come you're sitting in sand now?
I think next time, I'm going to get you.
Robert Conrad was 84.
The Top 5 at 5.
It's the Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. All right, a little bit ago, I guess it's almost an hour ago now, we were talking about the fact that the state of Illinois, there's a bill in the state of Illinois. We wanted to get to some phone calls about this, but we ran out of time, so I'm going to give people an opportunity to weigh in on this. There is a bill that is being introduced down in Springfield that would bring back gas station attendants. That if you wanted to pump your own gas, you couldn't do it in the state of Illinois. You have to have an attendant do it.
Classic Illinois doing stuff we can't really understand.
Right, for exactly no reasons whatsoever. Now, our own Lauren Lapka, who is, of course, from the state of Illinois. She was born and raised here, grew up in Orland Park, went off to go work in her television career, was in Eugene, Oregon for a piece, as my grandfather used to say.
A little more than a year, how about that?
Yeah, and while you were there, Oregon's got that. That had that law on the books and actually just amended the law. So they said to you now in Oregon, you can opt out and you can self-serve your own gas if you want to do it during certain hours, which I don't understand. I don't understand how this would necessarily be faster. Now, you said you liked it.
Yeah. Well, again, think about it, especially here in Chicago where weather can be super brutal. You don't have to get out of your car to pump gas. It's really nice.
That part's appealing to me. But we all know why they're doing this. Yes. To create a tax avenue.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They're going to somehow tax us. It's going to go, oh, we now have gas pump attendants. And then a few months later, we're introducing the new gas pump attendant tax. That'll be on top of your gas tax.
And the gas station's going to have to charge you more because they got to go pay for the attendant.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the attendant's going to have to be a member of the Teamsters or something, right?
Exactly.
And that's the way that's
union
have to
situation
go
going down here,
right? And all of a sudden, you know, now we got a whole thing going there. And the next thing you know, it's going to be $6 a gallon. And for what? When you can just go out there and pump your own tane down in New Orleans.
The Illinois exodus continues.
Yeah,
people see this stuff. They're like, I'm moving to Nashville. I'm getting on Redfin, and I'm looking for houses in Nashville.
That's what they all do. That is true. That's what they do. And then Nashville is just going to be, you know what, for all you people who want to move to Nashville, I got one thing for you, my friend. Try to get anywhere in less than an hour down there. There's an organizational issue in terms of the roads. Anyway, still a lovely town though, but I prefer it here. I don't know, for reasons I don't quite understand as well as I did a few years ago, but I still like it.
I mean, Chicago's a superior town, no doubt about it, but yeah. In terms of living.
Yeah, it's just makes it, we find ways here in the state of Illinois and in the city of Chicago to make things just you know, that much more difficult. Please, the person who is suggesting this in the state legislature needs to really rethink what they're thinking about right now. Right now.
Who introduced this again? I'm sorry.
Legislator? Hold on. I have the legislator's name up here. I was going
to... I've got it. Hang on. I can tell you.
I was actually going to not mention her name because I didn't want to necessarily start with creating the kind of trouble that that sort of thing does when you do it, right? I mean, all of a sudden, the next thing you know, then I'll get a call from her office. Why did you mention her name? Do you realize what's happening right now? She's being hit by Russian internet trolls.
Well, she really wants it. She should be proud.
I have her name if you want it. Hold on.
Let me.
I got it.
I know, but let me look at it real fast here, too, because I have to figure out if I know who she is. All right. Camille Lilly from Oak Park. She's a Democrat from Oak Park.
We need answers, Camille.
Yeah. Hey, you should get Camille on the blower, and maybe we should just do it that way first. Have her explain herself, because I'll be honest. I don't get it. I mean, again, we talked about this an hour ago. When I was a little kid, that's, you know, you pull in the gas station. And first of all, when I pulled into the gas station with my parents, I was jumping up and down in the front seat because I didn't have a seatbelt. There was no car seat. There was no anything. I'm jumping up and down. And and I believe that the dashboard was made out of razor blades, if I'm not mistaken, back then in the car. So this was a very different era. I will admit to that. And my dad, sometimes I would stick my head out, half my body out like a dog out of the window. And my dad would say, "Hey, stop that. You're obstructing my view." It was, had nothing to do with safety. But you'd go into the gas station, and there were, and you know, guys would line up, and you sit there, and but you know, the guy that want to have a conversation, you know, with the eyes. I like the isolation, sort of like the independence, the rugged individualism that goes with pumping your own gas.
There should be an option. Click a button if you want a guy to run out.
Well, they got a place. I'm telling you. And again, I mentioned this, and then we'll get right to your phone calls. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. There is a gas station I go to all the time in Chicago. It's got your option for whether you want somebody else to pump your gas or you can pump your gas. And 9 times out of 10, people pull up to that pump, realize it's the wrong pump, and they drive away from it. Sometimes they get scared and just drive off the whole gas station. I was like, I don't know what that is. Marge, just get out of here. All right. Okay, let's talk to Kathy here. 312-981-7200. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, I had that question. Actually, I grew up that way, too. My best friend, one of my best, very best friends to this day, his father owned a gas station. He started when he was 10, pumping our gas.
10.
You know, I knew him from when I was really little. But anyway, I work at a gas station, a very, very busy one. Mm-hmm. It's on a main corner in Plainfield.
Oh.
And, if it's 40 below zero, I told the producer I'm going to be 56 next month, you know, and I have arthritis in my hands, but I'm not going out there to pump somebody's gas.
Right. Well, I don't know. Are they going to ask you?
$12 an hour.
I don't think they're going to ask you, right?
What? But on Sundays, I'm the only one there.
Are you in the box? Are you in that little box?
Like no, it's an open gas station. My boss is there. She's there. Our head lead cashier is there.
I've always wondered this question. I've always had this question about the box. I know you're not in a box, but maybe you're familiar with this because you work in a gas station. I've noticed sometimes there's no door to that box. How do people get into that box and out of that box?
There is. You just can't see it. You don't know where it is. You're not supposed to know where it is.
Okay, good. Thank God.
the point being is, I mean, seriously, who's going to go out and do it? And the ladies I work with during the day, they're all older, too.
Yeah. Well, who needs it? I'm telling you right now.
The politicians have to think about this. They don't retired people work in gas stations. It's not just young kids anymore. I mean, you've got a lot of older people that work in gas stations. And you expect them to go out and pump gas for somebody?
I know. I don't get it. I'm with you.
No, not you.
I know. I just want to say, Kathy, I am on your side on this, and I happen to think that the arthritis, especially, kicks. I have arthritis of the brain. The last thing I need right now is to think about
it's
that.
Cold air.
Right, exactly, Kathy. I appreciate your time. Let's come right back to the phone call 312-981-7200 on this. But first, here is Lauren Lapka. She's got the traffic and the weather. Brocon Show right here on 720 WGN. All right, we're talking about this. Taking phone calls on this topic that came up an hour ago on the program, but we got involved in some other things. I want to come back to it, which is an Illinois state legislator from Oak Park, the People's Republic of Oak Park, has decided it would be a really good idea to make it mandatory in the state of Illinois for gas station attendants to pump the gas so that we as individuals can't pump the gas. Now, I have to say there's one advantage, I think, to this, which is then I often spill the gas on myself while I'm pumping it. I tend to be a little sloppy with the nozzle.
I always feel a little dirty after I do the gas.
Yeah, you know, sometimes
who's touching the handle.
Right, or you step in it, and then all of a sudden you smell it in your car. Today, I actually spilled the gas all over the hole, which I thought was really kind of, you know, like I was pulling it out, and then because there was still kind of pumping when I was pulling it out, and kind of got it in and around the hole, was dripping down the side of the car, and I was like, oh, no. I had to go get a car wash immediately. And I thought, well, what if I just lit the side of the car? You know, like, you know, sort of burn it off, you know, like you're doing a flambe. And I thought they would not like that at Apple Chevrolet. So these are all the things that went through my head today. But I still want to be able to pump my own gas because I know what this is going to cost me. It's going to be weird. Mike, you're on WGN, 312-981-7200. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, this is Mike.
Yes, that's you. Twice.
Yeah,
Mike.
Last summer, I took the family out to the wonderful beaches out in New Jersey. And in New Jersey, you can only do full serve. You don't even have an option.
Right.
It was really strange. It didn't cost that much more, but I didn't like having... I'd rather have the choice and do it myself.
Let me just ask you a question, Mike. Do you think when Illinois gets this, it's not going to cost more?
It's definitely going to cost more.
Right. That's why they're doing it. That's exactly why they're doing it. It's sort of a make-work thing, too, for people. I don't know what... I mean, it seems to me that of all the aspirational jobs that exist, especially when you watch like television commercials about, you know, get on, you know, this website to find a job doing this or that, or, you know, go to some sort of technical institute and learn this or that, the pumping of the gas seems basically like only the sort of the level of employee that has just recently been released from incarceration. That's about with this. It's kind of where you're going to get them, because I think anybody else who wants it, like any other kind of a job, They're thinking the Uber, right? I mean, what do you need? Or you know, delivering food. I mean, I cannot think of where the lowest level could possibly be. This is about it, right? And I don't even begin to understand. Gail, you're on WGN. Go ahead, Gail.
Yeah, what I want to know is, will they also check my oil, my tire pressure, and clean the windshield?
Well, if they did, it would take us 18 hours to get gasoline into our car. Right? And besides, and isn't it true that your car tells you all of that now anyway? Right? Most modern cars tell you if your tires are low, or you need oil, or whatever it is. I mean, if you're driving a car that doesn't tell you that, then you have other things happening at that moment, right? Maybe they do need to do that. And then that's going to it's going to screw it up for all the rest of us. I don't need
Well, you know what? Now we might as well make it a two-people job. They can have somebody working on the outside and somebody working on the inside.
Right. That's right. And we call that, in Chicago, we call that a carjacking. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's talk to Patrick. You're on WGN. Hello, Patrick.
Well, you know, like you were saying, back in the day, I was a gas jockey, and they had four pumps for full serve and four or six pumps for self-serve. And you paid extra for the full serve. Yeah, like the lady just asked, we checked everything. And, you know, usually by the time we were done, we got a tip. Usually you have to be more personal. Not always. Some people were just like you. Would come in up, crack the window, slide out at 20, say, fill it up, and roll that window up.
$20, right.
And look forward to make sure that they did not look at you at all and would not give eye contact.
Absolutely. I did that. I wasn't even paying, and I did that. My dad was driving the car, and I still looked forward and acted like I wasn't watching the transaction when it was happening.
I'm not here. So, yeah, to me, it shouldn't be mandatory. It should definitely, I don't know if anybody's aware of this, if you're handicapped, if you have a placard, you can pull into any gas station and blow your horn and they have to come out and pump your gas.
That's
people
interesting.
Know that. That's a good one. I'd like for people to share that, because after we stopped being full service and we're just self-serve. We'd have people pull up and just sit there laying on the horn, and we'd be like, you know, what is this guy thinking? You know, and then you'd go out there, and the guy'd be like, yeah, I'm handicapped. Can you pump my gas? And you'd be like, oh, I felt like, you know, you'd feel like such a jerk, you know, bad-mouthing the guy that's beat them. But, yeah.
Yeah, but you know people, what? It's the same people. Like, I'm going to tell you, though, those people, sometimes those people get the placards and they don't really need them, right? Or they get a placard for somebody else.
Again, sometimes yes, but sometimes there's mental disabilities that people look 100% normal, you know, but they've got something. There's a reason they got the disability card. Right. So don't always judge people.
I know
it's hard to, because you look at them, you're like, that guy looks 100% fine. He might have something that you don't know about, or she might.
Well, then I definitely don't want him pulling into my gas station. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it. Jeff, you're on WGN. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, bro, this is a pinch on small businesses. I mean, yeah, prices are going to go up for the candy and for the soda and for all that other stuff, too, if they have to start employing people at $13, $14, $15 an hour. And then they have to do it for all the hours that they're open. And some of these places are still 24 hours. Some places are, you know, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. I mean, it's a tax grab by the state. They want more wages. And obviously, these employees are going to have to be trained, and there's going to have to be state certification. There's going to have to be fees. I mean, this could be even pushed by the electronic vehicle lobby. So there's a lot of things to think about on this. And Camille Lilly's my state rep, and she also represents River Grove and Elmwood Park, some of Franklin Park, and a little bit of Chicago. And she's got a challenger now as of this weekend for the first time in 10 years. Somebody's going to run against her as an independent on the ballot.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, this does get her in the headlines. I don't know if it's for the right reasons. But it does who would be for this?
I did this like 40-some years, 45 years ago. I worked for my dad, and I just, you know, I pumped gas, and I cleaned the windows, and I checked the oil. And, you know, I think they're going to have to hire a lot of people. These small businesses are going to get pinched.
Well, were you a kid? How old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, I was doing it for free because I was like 10 years old.
Right. See, that's the point, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's like you would have like the kids like in a gas station, suburban gas station, like the city downtown is a little bit different. But you know, there were either suburban or, you know, out of, you know, the boonies somewhere. You've got the kids are coming out and doing it, and nobody thought twice about it. But now, as you pointed out, there's going to be a whole other thing. And you just might have actually hit, and this is what I love about Chicago, and I love people who are just absolutely tuned into what this town has always been about, which is you got to follow the money, right? So where did the money come from? And all of a sudden, now, that's a genius assertion on your point, that it's possible that the electronic vehicle industry is like, hey, you know what would really be funny? What really screw up these gas people is making this mandatory and then having, you know, the price of gas just go up by the just the sure mathematics of it.
It would drive a lot of people out of business, you know, and because you're right. And somebody said it before, it's mom and pops and it's older folks behind the counter. They're not going out. So now they got to hire somebody else to do all that stuff.
Right. Exactly. You know, right. And especially, you know, you got the one guy in the, thank you, man, who went the one guy in the box. See, I now wonder, now what happens with the one guy in the box? There's so many gas stations downtown where they got the, you know, the one dude in the box who looks scared anyway. He didn't want to come out of that box. And I do not blame him, because you think about some of the gas stations in which that's, you know, the neighborhoods in which those gas stations exist, and you want to come out of the, and the, all of a sudden you're going to have 12 pumps going, and the guy's going to have to come out of the box and do that, or there's no place for the people to be other than outside the box, and they want to get back in the box, because they don't necessarily want to be outside the box in the neighborhood, that, because if there's no cars, I don't think so. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I understand that this was an accident and you made a massive mistake in a moment of fear.
I don't know what that's, I think that it's not intended for us, I don't believe. But thank you anyway. All right, we've got Mr. Richard Rubber talking about the Oscars and whether or not really Korea won the war last night through Hollywood. We'll talk about that. But first, news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom in 2.
Radio Chicago, WGN.
The Rokon Show.
These weak arms are heavy. They vomit on a sweater already. Mom's spaghetti. He's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. But he keeps on forgetting what he broke down. The whole crowd goes so loud. He opens his...
All right, this is from the Oscars last night. This is Eminem performing. Richard Roper's just stepped into the studio. He has his own thoughts on exactly what happened here. And I was not sure why he was there. Can you explain that to me? I liked it.
I could try to explain. So Eminem, in 2003, almost 20 years ago, was up for Best Song for Lose Yourself, the song from 8 Mile that he performed last night. I remember being at the Oscars at the time, and we were told backstage that Eminem was not going to be showing up. He had been invited to show up and perform and, you know, perhaps win. And he had declined to attend. And, you know, the myth is that, oh, you know, Eminem was so street and bad and too cool for the Oscars. And it was actually the opposite of that. Back in 2003, he was absolutely convinced he wasn't going to win. And he didn't want to come all the way to L.A. to lose. Because, you know, back in the day, those traditional songs would always win for best song. Like Moon River, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Right? You know, High Hopes. Those are all actual. I mean, White Christmas won, which should have won, you know, back in the day.
All right.
So he actually decided to stay home with his then young daughter in Detroit and went to sleep and was shocked to find out he had won. And then all these years went by. He's got a new album out. So I think they figured it would be a cool thing to have him come out and perform. It was still very odd, though, because it was like, well, what does this have to do with tonight?
Right. Because it's bad enough that we have to sit through five songs that are the nominated songs, and then a sixth song, which again is Eminem, and that's a great song. And I thought, well, maybe he'd updated the lyrics. Maybe there's something. I don't understand exactly what's going on.
No, he's still rhyming Mekhi Phifer and Lifer and something about spaghetti and all that stuff. And you know, there's a lot of talk about like some folks in the audience were jamming, and others like everyone keeps showing like Martin Scorsese and his daughter look kind of like stunned. That was because there was actually strobe lights, though, and they said a lot of people actually couldn't see what was happening on stage, so they were hearing a recording, they thought, or a performance, but they weren't even sure he was up there. Or is that just somebody's Uncle Mo who does a really good, because he does not now, I mean, he's like 50, right?
Yeah.
Eminem
right
around there. And he kind of looks like, you know, a really good Eminem cover act.
Right. He doesn't look like himself.
Yeah. And especially the way he dressed yesterday. He looked a little bit like, you know, he was just out hanging, you know, watching somebody's Little League game or something.
Right. And then he's the guy that comes up to you and goes, by the way, if you do need a new mortgage.
Yeah.
I am on Team Hochberg. Call me.
Selling,
you know, he's got that
some
sort of
T-shirt merches too. So that was a little bit odd. And, you know, we talk about this all the time. And as long as they're going to do 24 categories at the Oscars, it's going to be 3.5 hours long. And about half of it's going to be completely boring. Because you have all these categories where people you never heard of are winning an award for something you don't understand for working on a movie you've never seen.
There was a moment last night that was so unbelievably awkward. When at the end, when Parasite wins, which in and of itself was awkward, we'll get to that in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Oscars are already about 17 minutes over time, right? If they weren't going to stop at 10 o'clock Chicago time, it was 10:17.
Okay.
And then they decide after the first, you know, person says whatever they were going to say with an interpreter or try not to be with an interpreter. Then they had the woman. Then the only woman who speaks English in the cast and crew of this film was going to get up and say something. And then they turn the lights off and they're trying to play the music. I'm like, okay, goodbye. And Tom Hanks, no less a figure in Hollywood than Tom Hanks, had to jump up and start screaming, "Put the lights up!" Like he's a producer. And they did.
Lights up, lights up. Yeah, they had a chant for that.
And then they had a whole thing where, and then she got to, you know, speak about the whole thing, which is, listen, if you're 17 minutes late, who cares? It's the best picture. That's what everybody's been waiting for. You want to hear Joaquin Phoenix and his long and rambling speech. It had something to do with sentient beings and whether or not, you know, a fish should have a thought. And it said, I don't know, whatever it was.
Cow rights.
Fine. Right. Bovine rights. Which I got to be worried about that. I don't know. I have so much to be worried about. But there is just a sense that without a host, it has no steering wheel.
Exactly.
And I don't get. And they got to get that fixed, because they did have a couple. Listen, the Chris Rock and Steve Martin bit, great.
Yeah, they were great. Want to hear a little bit of that?
Yes.
We got a little bit of that.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Cynthia Erivo is here tonight.
Cynthia did such a great job in Harriet hiding black people that the Academy got her to hide all the black nominees. Is Eddie Murphy under this stage?
Eddie, I loved you in Dolomite.
One of the great things about Chris Rock is for 30 years now, and he always has been edgy, but he says everything with the biggest grin. And it sounds like he's giving you a compliment no matter what he says to you. So, you are the dumbest person alive! And everyone, yeah, I am. The Jeff Bezos stuff was great, too, where he said, got divorced and still the... And I agree. Steve Martin and Chris Rock and Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph.
Right.
They could all four be the co-host. Right?
I just suggested it earlier. I said, get eight.
Right.
Spread the risk.
Yeah, they've done
right?
that.
Have them all do something. And if one of them makes a mistake, like I said, you take them out and you put them in jail. Right? You just arrest them in the parking lot. But in Harvey Weinstein wing of Hollywood jail. And then you have an opportunity for everybody to be that. Listen, Twitter's going to hate you no matter what you do. So stop trying to worry about, that's true, on social media there's going to be a problem. Or you had a tweet 20 years ago that changes how people look at you. That doesn't. Everybody's an a-hole on Twitter. That's everybody. True.
They are off to a stumbling start when Janelle Monáe, God love her, she came out. First, I never, doing the Mr. Rogers thing, but she had a rebutton her blouse. And Mr. Rogers never busted out that third button. And then proceeded to go into a musical number that featured dancing Jokers and World War I soldiers.
Yes.
The Jokers representing Joker and World War I, 1917. And I'm thinking, like, imagine those young showbiz hopefuls. I got a casting call. I'm going to be one of the dancing Jokers.
See, but when Billy Crystal would come out and do all the songs, it was funny.
Yes.
That wasn't anything funny about that last night. It was actually depressing.
But he had dancing Lecters, like Hannibal Lecters behind him.
All right, stand by. We'll come back. We'll talk about something. I don't understand the Parasite thing. Richard Roper will be here to explain it. But first, because he's sitting right here right now, here's Lauren Lapka. She's got the traffic and the weather.
I've had my adventure. I don't need something new. I'm afraid of what I'm risking if I follow you into the unknown.
That's Adele Dazeem from the Oscars last night. And they even made a joke about that Idina Menzel was mispronounced by John Travolta.
Mm.
And when the Oscars are self-referential about the Oscars,
they
kind of lost me a little bit. Again, they need a host.
They need a host or a group of hosts.
We need some sort of steering wheel. We need some kind of comedy. We need some kind of line to go down, because going out and doing musical numbers, it would be like the Super Bowl going back to Up with People. It just doesn't make any sense.
The musical numbers, and even the legends like Randy Newman and Elton John, the numbers really are kind of underwhelming live. They take so long to go through. And then Billie Eilish for the In Memoriam segment, and I know, listen, she's got a lot of talent and the kids love her and all this stuff, but you're going to take on Yesterday, you better bring it. And she did not make anyone forget Paul McCartney there. I thought she kind of just sleepwalked her way through the performance. It was okay. But that, again, you want to do that tribute segment, that's fine, but there's still a better way of doing that. I think they should still have a feature. I've advocated this now for 20 years. The girlfriends of Leonardo DiCaprio should come out all one by one as the presenters. It'd be fantastic. And people were asking this fun stuff. His date yesterday, her name is Camila Morone. And I know her because she played Bruce Willis's daughter in the horrific remake of Death Wish from a couple of years ago. She played his daughter who played soccer at Evanston Township High School.
Oh.
Quite a movie that was. Mm. So she's moved on now.
Yeah.
Al Pacino's essentially her stepfather. Her mother never married him. But yeah, so I'm sure. Who's coming by today?
So what? It was fun to watch Al Pacino last night. Al Pacino is having such an amazing moment in his career. He's probably working more now.
Yeah, he's got a new series coming out.
So. Right. That's on, I think, Amazon, right?
Correct.
Yep. About Nazi hunters. Boy, I'll tell you something. The Nazis are taking it on the chin for the last year and a half. They really took it on the chin in 1945, but now we're back.
Imagine Al.
Right?
Is Franz home? You know, like just knocking on the door in some suburban place, you know. Is the kindly janitor here? Who's been hiding for 60 years. And then Al goes and gets him. Yeah.
But Al Pacino is having this incredible moment. He seemed to be enjoying himself.
He is enjoying himself. Yeah.
And Scorsese seemed to be enjoying himself. I mean, the funny thing about this is they probably weren't going to win anyway. But it is an upset that Parasite won Best International, but then won Best Picture. And I don't know that deserves that. I think that's kind of some weird, like, you know, Hollywood self-flagellation. Because the other films were better in that category.
I gave it 3 stars when it came out. We talked about it. And I get its appeal. They're now going to do an American version of it because people don't like to read the movies. I didn't think it was as great and revolutionary as a lot of critics did. It's an interesting film about class warfare. Has a little bit of almost Get Out to it, but I think Get Out was a superior film. It actually reminded me a little bit more of From Dusk Till Dawn, where George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino were bank robbers who all of a sudden found themselves in a vampire movie. Like, there's this, and that's not what happens here for people who haven't seen it, but there's a huge tonal shift in the, and it's really kind of a dark comedy, but I thought it just kind of went off the rails. I wasn't, some people think the last 30 minutes were just brilliant cinema, and I'm like,
I don't think so.
Seen that before.
Now, there's a tonal shift. Jojo Rabbit, which I think is also a superior film, and it was one of my favorite of last year. That has a tonal shift, too.
Yeah.
But you get it. You understand what's going on. You see, they set you up for it. They let you know. As a matter of fact, set you up for it. They actually give you visual clues by the time you get to it, so that it touches you on every single level. And this is a moment of Hollywood, which I just do not get. And Hollywood, chose and the how you become the winner of Best Picture in terms of how the voting happens. It's not like the normal voting. If you would like an explanation, Richard Roper in our podcast, The Best Movies, The Race for the Gold, the Oscar edition, in The Best Movies, the episode 6, which is the final, there's only 6 episodes per season for us, that final episode where we talk about the Best Picture nominees, you explain the whole thing. It's a mathematical nightmare how they get to this, because it's not... Yeah. It's like Hall of Fame voting.
It's Iowa caucus like.
Yeah, it really is.
With the app not working.
Yeah, it makes zero sense.
And we did talk about how there could be an upset there. I agree with you. Listen, it should have won definitely for international language film. Although Pain and Glory, which is the Antonio Banderas film that he was nominated for Best Actor for, that's another really great foreign film. Is the entry from Spain this year. So it felt a little bit like the Academy felt so guilty about the lack of diversity in a lot of other categories, they went overboard. Now, it was fun. I mean, Bong Joon-ho is hilarious and great and cool and had a great time. He actually apologized. They engraved the Oscars on site now. They used to take the Oscar away from you and send it to you like 2 months later
ABC
or whatever.
Engraving.
So they engrave it right now, which is cool. But he apologized to the engraver because you know how the grocery store says like 10 items or less, the Oscars, it's usually 2 items. He had 4. He's like, so he held up the line.
Well, they had the most amount of Oscars, film?
But he individually, because he wrote the screenplay, so he wins for that. International film, he won for that. Then Best Director and Best Film. And in all those cases, he actually won because he's a producer and co-writer as well as director. So he actually physically gets an Oscar.
But one for screenplay.
Yeah.
From, it was original screenplay, right?
Yes.
Okay, because...
Jojo Rabbit was adapted from a novel.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And Taika Waititi, who's the guy who is the guy behind Jojo Rabbit, who plays Hitler in Jojo Rabbit, because he couldn't find anybody else to do it, and he just steals the show, is a guy who, he's going to be one of the great 21st century artists, I think, film artists.
Yeah.
He's just got that whole thing going. And I'm sure that this Bong Joon-ho, right?
Bong
Joon-ho. Anyway, don't even go there. He's obviously clearly going to have an amazing career as well.
Yeah, and he's already done a couple films that people can look up that are amazing.
This is like the coming out of the new wave, the new great artist.
Yes,
And Quentin Tarantino now all of a sudden becomes
people like that. Yes,
and Tarantino becomes like one of the old. He's sort of like caught in the old guard. He's not quite Scorsese, but he's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. So it is. So last night was a lot of fun in that respect. But how Parasite won for screenplay, and it's in Korean, right? I mean, it's the screenwriters who vote for that, right? Mm-hmm. Don't they have to read the screenplay?
Everybody votes in the finals of the screenwriters nominate screenwriters, but then the whole Academy can vote for script. So I think in a lot of cases, a lot of Academy members watched Parasite in the last few weeks before voting closed, and they probably just enjoyed it in their home screening rooms. They might have had that same woman that was interpreting for everybody at their homes to interpret as well. She had the most screen time last night. She was wonderful.
She was great. She was at the Golden Globes.
She's actually going to. They say she's actually going to. This is serious. She wants to direct a movie making fun of the whole award circuit about an interpreter. And you could see her doing a satire based on that, which could be fun.
Oh man, I don't know the whole thing. I felt empty. You know what? It was weird. It was like, now I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It was like I was hungry 15 minutes later after the whole thing was done. I had a sense of loss because there are 9 nominees and 7 of them were better than Parasite. And that's the thing that really that really bothered me. And I don't think I'm crazy. I was just a fan. You're the critic. But I mean, you stopped me. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Fantastic. The Irishman, fantastic.
Yeah.
Jojo Rabbit.
1917, for sure. Right. I mean, I'd put it in the same category like as Marriage Story. I didn't love it, but, you know, I liked it. That was nominated. Here's what I always say about the Oscars. Look, you know, it's fun. It's fun to kind of make fun of and enjoy the jokes if they're there. My favorite time of the movie year, one of my favorite times, is right now, the Monday after the Oscars, because now, with this, we wrap a bow on this, and we don't have to talk about these movies again,
ever.
And we could look forward to what's coming out this Friday and the following Friday and every weekend to come.
That's very true. And if you like Mandalorian, by the way, I would like to point out that Taika Waititi, the guy from, is directed the finale of that and another one of the episodes during it. And he's the voice of one of the droids.
Yeah.
This guy is unbelievably great.
Directed Thor Ragnarok as well.
Right.
It was the best of the Thor movies.
Without question.
More, it was, you know, very rock and roll and cool. Yep. It had a little Tarantino-esque feel to it.
Yes. And people, if you have not seen Jojo Rabbit, see Jojo Rabbit. It's coming out now, finally. I think it's right now. It's like a week away from being rentable. Mm-hmm. It is really, it's really something. All right. We will return, and we're going to talk to these foosball guys that you talked about. This. You love this documentary.
Oh, documentary Foosballers.
Yes.
Yes.
And the guys who did the documentary are here.
Cool.
And we're going to talk about what that's all about, because I had no idea that we could do a documentary about foosball. We'll find out exactly why it's important. And we'll do that after the news, coming your way in 2 minutes.
WGN in the morning with Bob Surratt. Everything you wanted to know about getting your new Real ID driver's license, direct from Secretary of State Jesse White, after the 8:30 news.
Radio Chicago, WGN.
It's the Rokan Show right here, 720 WGN. All right, now, Richard Roper is here. He was here last week. You were talking about films that are coming out over the weekend that you find particularly interesting. We always do that on Thursdays and Fridays on this program. And you mentioned Foosballers.
Right.
Foosballers, which is a documentary about, well, foosball.
Which, when you think about it, you know, we've never had one as far as I know. We're gonna talk to our director in a second here, but it seems like it's such a cool thing to talk about because, you know, if you grew up in a certain time and place, it was part of the fabric of so many basements and pubs going all the way back to the 70s, but there's a history even before that. But it's still a big deal, and there's a tournament and everything, Rokan, a whole tournament circuit I was telling you about.
I'm completely confused by this, but now, thank God we've got a guy here, Joe Islinga, because it turns out that Joe, this is his film, right? This is you made this.
Yeah.
Now, you're a Chicago guy, right?
Originally from Chicago, that's right.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Where are you from?
Rolling Meadows, Northwest.
Oh, wow. That's Kevin stepped away from the studio right there. Where'd you go to high school?
Arizona. We moved to Arizona when I was about 10, so.
All right.
There was a problem. They had to get out of the state. Don't ask any questions.
I should have done this in a pre-interview. All right. So explain to me what it was about foosball that drew you in as a filmmaker to go make a documentary.
So we had, like most people, no idea that pro foosball was a thing. Mm-hmm. We thought, you know, it'd be funny if people played pro foosball. They have cornhole on ESPN.
Exactly.
Now.
Axe throwing, sports. Right?
Yeah, axe throwing. Ultimate Frisbee. Yeah. So we Googled it on a whim, thinking that, oh, this would be hilarious. You know, let's see what we find. And sure enough, all these different videos with millions of hits of people playing foosball. You can't even see the people's faces, but they had millions of hits. And we're like, incredible. Okay, yeah. Who are these people watching the videos?
And they have like drone shots, right? They have like overhead shots of the foosball table.
Overhead. They use GoPros and cranes, you know. So a lot of these videos were from Europe, and it's really big there. They, you know, they have big stadiums that they'll sell out with foosball.
Yeah, because it's essentially tabletop soccer. So which stand to reason why it would be so popular in Europe, right?
Exactly. And that's where the game actually originated in Europe back, you know, in the turn of the century. But so we went down this rabbit hole with these foosball videos, and we're like, this is so weird. And then really that moment where we said, okay, let's make a movie, when we found out in the 70s here in the States, they had a $1 million pro tour. And that's there were guys that would drop out of school, they would quit their jobs and join the pro tour, and they would make tens of thousands of dollars playing foosball. You could go to a tournament and win a Corvette, a Porsche, $10,000. And when you're a 17-year-old kid, you think that's your golden ticket.
Yeah, and that you're going to be doing it forever. One of the things I really did like about the film, though, Joe, is that, you know, this could be almost like, you know, dodgeball or something, but the actual subject, you did a kind of a classic, you know, I think, you know, classy documentary style where the subjects you talk about, the world-class foosball players, you treat their stories with respect. You're not making fun of these people because a lot of them have really interesting stories. Sometimes it's generational, families involved, but I like the way you let them tell all their stories.
Thank you. Yeah, that was one of the things that, you know, it started out as a funny curiosity. Mm. And then once we started to get to know the people and get to know the story, this is a real sports story. This is a story that, you know, isn't just a topical, oh, this is funny, haha. This is something that has a lot of substance to it, a lot of integrity. And we just thought it'd be like really great to actually tell their story in a proper way, do it like all those great 30 for 30 documentaries. We wanted to give it
It has that feel, yeah.
So.
Although, to be fair, there is the one, you know, you're going to have at least one player that's from a trailer park in Florida.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And when you interview mom, she's got a parrot on her shoulder.
Oh, man.
I mean, you're going to have that. You know, that's part of it. But you also have, like, a doctor, though, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, and people you wouldn't expect to be foosball aficionados.
There's a ton of humor, you know, throughout. But, yeah, we always wanted to keep the integrity of the movie. He's a chief of anesthesia. Also, a former backup dancer for Marky Mark.
Yes.
There's a world...
Whoa. The guy's a doctor and an anesthesiologist?
And former backup dancer for Marky Mark. And world-class foosball
player. And world champion foosball player.
Yeah.
He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He plays foosball. He's actually a really good roller skater, too.
to go hand in hand. Was probably one tournament at least where people were on roller skates in the 70s, foosballing.
Well, that's how he actually ended up playing foosball at the roller skating rink back in, you know, 70s, 80s. Mm. That's where they were. They were in game rooms. They were in roller rinks. And that's where he ended up playing. And when you have roller skates, you have a height advantage. So as a kid, you could see 3 or 4 inches above the table. So you can sit there and you have an advantage.
Well, you do a nice job of reminding us how it's been a part of the popular culture. Because, of course, there's a clip, a brief snippet of Dazed and Confused. Because there's a scene where McConaughey walks through the bar and they're playing foosball. And then, of course, Joey and Chandler with their foosball table. That was an iconic part of the Friends arc, right?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, you walk into a bar and 9 times out of 10, if they have a foosball table, people see it and their eyes light up and say, hey, they got foosball, you know, and they get really stoked about it. And that was another thing that we knew, that foosball is such a big part of the culture, but no one knows about pro foosball. So,
great.
So is it the same guy who wins all these tournaments, or is it like, is it competitive?
It's extremely competitive. So, I will say that there is one dominant player. That's Tony Spreadman. He's actually here in Chicago with us. He's going to be at the screening tomorrow at the Music Box.
Cool.
And he is one of the most, you know, hands down dominant player in singles. But with foosball,
there's doubles, right?
There's singles, there's doubles, and there's actually mixed where you'll play with a man and woman against another man and woman.
Oh.
So
think of all the relationships that ended over doubles foosballs with couples playing back in the day.
Or began.
There you go.
Terry Rue, the guy from Louisiana, the former backup dancer, him and his wife play. And she's also a world champion. His daughter, a world champion.
See, now, right? Well, that's one of those things where you see when athletes get together, that they always have athlete offspring. That's
she's
the
got
way
the foosball
goes.
Gene.
Well,
DNA.
A lot of the younger, I mean, I say younger, they're anywhere from 20 years old to 35, but the newer generation of pro foosball players, they're all second generation. Cool. So their parents were players in the 70s, And they pass down that gene, they grew up that with it, yeah. crazy foosball gene.
It's awesome. Foosballers. It's a film by Joe Hislinga, who's with us right now. And tomorrow night, there is a special screening at the Music Box Theater at 7 p.m. Go to musicboxtheater.com. Tickets are $12. You're going to do a Q&A with you and Tony Spreadman, this guy.
The guy we're talking
we're
about.
Find
the Michael
out,
Jordan of
right,
foosball.
Why it is that this happens. I'm telling you, Richard Roper loved it. So congratulations on that. Yeah.
People should check it out.
It's a big deal. All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much, Joe.
Cool. Thanks for being here. Yeah.
All right. We got the news coming up for the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom at the top of the hour. But right now, Lauren Lapka tells us what's happening on the traffic and the weather. It's the Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. All right, Richard Roper's in the studio with us. We were talking about the Oscars. We were talking about the hits and the misses of last night. And then we stopped and we talked to the director and writer of Foosballers, the documentary, which Richard liked very much. It's going to be at the Music Box Theater tomorrow night, musicboxtheater.com, if you'd like to go see
you
it.
You know, one of the cool things is, Joe was just saying here, too, it's like, you know, these documentary films, you do a little crowdsourcing or crowdfunding or kickstarting or whatever you want to do. And it's a great way for people to get into movies of different kinds. And Matthew Cherry, who won for best animated short mm-hmm. yesterday at the
Hair
Oscars.
Love.
For Hair Love. It's a 6-minute movie, and he did the same thing, just raised the money. And he's got a great story, by the way. He grew up in Chicago. He went up to Loyola, which is up in Winnetka, I think, North Shore.
Loyola Academy.
And then played wide receiver for the Akron Zips and was like second team All-American and actually got drafted and kicked around the pros for a while, but also wanted to become a filmmaker. And that, you know, he made this beautiful 6-minute animated short, raised the money to do it, and now has an Academy Award. And actually, after he won last night and, you know, went into all the parties and everything, he went straight to the set of Mixed-ish, which is the spinoff of Black-ish, mm-hmm. because he's directing TV episodes. He's a working TV director as well.
Wow.
So he brought the Oscar to work today.
That'll do it.
But it's neat because, you know, when you and I started, even 20 years ago, people say, oh, I want to get started in movies, and they, you know, have to try to raise the money. And a lot of times you'd hear these stories of filmmakers that would have to stop halfway through because, you know, it's not easy, but it's easier. There's ways you can make a movie on your phone.
Right.
You know, you used to have to get the, you know, the equipment, you know, the cameras and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, young Steven Spielberg was always, you know, reading the Universal lot at night when he was 18 for like extra pieces of film or some sort of lens or something. So it is a little bit more of a democratic small D process now.
So in terms of where this goes with the film industry, as we watched it last night, mm-hmm. obviously internationalism is a big deal. And I think if there's anything that we can take from Parasite winning last night, which again, controversial, at least I consider it to be controversial because I don't think that was the best film.
It wasn't.
But I think what you're seeing though is the international filmmakers, the international actors and actresses, you've seen this with Antonio Banderas and, mm-hmm. and Selma Hayek.
Penelope Cruz.
Right. Yeah. Other artists that come in and they can make movies in the United States, but then they're gigantic hits, you know, whether mm-hmm. it's in Spain or, you know, wherever it happens to be. It's kind of funny because once upon a time in Hollywood, it tells the story of a guy who was an actor who had to go to Italy to go make spaghetti westerns.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Eastwood style, sort of, basically.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the idea of, but now that was a fallback position. Now what you're seeing is these artists coming from other parts of the world coming to the United States. It's been really going on for a while, mm-hmm. right? Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which is of course made by the Chinese government, but it was the, you know, you've got these directors who become international giant directors, and they're doing things in English or they're doing it in Mandarin, they're doing whatever it happens to be. So I think that's what we get from that. And I wouldn't be surprised, as you mentioned Parasite now, there's a company that's going to try to make it in English, right?
It's going to happen. It's in the production already. It'll be a series, not a movie.
Oh.
But it'll be the same story. Essentially, I don't know the details, and I don't know if they do yet. I hope they're not going to. I mean, if they're going to do it that way, they should set it in Boston. I mean, make it a completely Americanized version, which they do with all kinds of movies. We're going to talk about a movie later.
Don't we already have that called Shameless? Isn't that basically the same?
No, because Shameless just has the lower class. They don't have the rich people that Parasite has. But you know, I would like to see that. But we're going to see a movie later this. So many American movies, people don't even realize. Are originally, you know, they're remakes of films that were first, you know, The Departed, the great gangster film, was a film called Infernal Affairs, which was a Korean film from the early 2000s. We're going to see a movie later this week called Downhill with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell. That's why they were together yesterday. And that's a remake of a foreign film called Force Majeure. The other cool thing we're seeing is that American-made films do so well overseas, and that's how they make all their money. We talked last week about Birds of Prey, the Harley Quinn movie with Margot Robbie. It wasn't a huge hit. You know, it was R-rated, which is always going to work against it. It made like about $33 million here. It made $80 million overseas. So it's pretty much close to making close back to the budget already in its first week.
For those of us who've been watching the Oscars, or fans of movies and fans of television and all that, there were stars, you know, whether it was Jack Nicholson or Jack Lemmon or people like that who were perennials at these award shows, right? And they were considered the best of the best in their business. And now it's a new generation of guys who, back when we were kids, are now the ages of those guys in their 40s and 50s, right? Where you've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt and other people like that. Who do you think, who are some of the artists, both men and women, that you think that we're going to be looking at for the next 20 years in this?
I think Saoirse Ronan, for sure, who already has like a bundle of Academy Award nominations. You saw Timothy Chalamet yesterday as a presenter, who's an up-and-comer. The little dude from Jojo Rabbit. He's 10, but he's already killing it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and there's a lot of good young stars. It's interesting you mentioned that, Ro, because I think there used to be, even with the Jack Nicholson era, the old-school stars like Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman and Jack Nicholson, they would go to the Oscars every year as a sort of, whether they were nominated or presenting or not, as part of Hollywood royalty, and they felt that that was something you were almost obligated to do. The next generation doesn't really feel that way. You won't see, like, Julia Roberts showed up last year to present and then left, but you don't see Tom Cruise and Julia Roberts and a lot of other huge stars, Will Smith, in the crowd
anymore,
year in and year out at the Oscars. They go if they've got something to promote or they got a nomination, whereas the previous generation would go every year because it was the damn Oscars. It'd be interesting to see if the younger generation has a different... Now, Brad Pitt and Leo, they're a little bit different. They'll go... Then, of course, on the other end, you have Joe Pesci, who was probably making a sandwich in his kitchen in New Jersey around the time they were announcing Best Supporting Actor. Joe Pesci had no interest whatsoever in going to the Oscars last night.
But Joe Pesci's back. He's got other stuff coming out now.
He's got a few things coming out. He just never has wanted to do publicity.
Right.
Ever.
Well, he didn't want to work. He didn't work for 20 years.
Yeah. It's more just because he doesn't want that lifestyle. He likes to golf. He likes to spend time with his family. That's pretty much it.
And he's Joe Pesci. He can do whatever he wants. If my name were Oscar, I would have given him one last night for Best Supporting Actor because I thought he was the best in that crop as well. I start to wonder about the relevance of the Oscars. You know, I start to wonder because there are so many award shows, and the Oscars used to be it, right? It was like you'd see all the big stars, and it would be a big buildup and all of that. And now, because of award season, because they have the Golden Globes, which, you know, now are second in line, I think, to them.
But the Oscars still gets a bigger viewership than any of the other award shows. And as far as event television goes, it's everybody's behind the Super Bowl, but it's usually ahead of the World Series, the NBA Finals, you know, in terms of singular events. Yeah, it's got half of what it had 20 years ago. So does every other show. It still does have that bounce. Today, there were theaters in major urban areas that were sold out for Parasite, like on a Monday afternoon. Yeah. That's because it won the Academy Award.
Right.
And certain films like that will get a bounce. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, films like that, more people will check it out on home video. It's still worth, you know, a good $10, $20 million at the box office, which is a big deal if you're a smaller film.
You know, the other thing, too, now that because of digital download, it does make sense when the Oscar nominations come out. It would make sense for whatever your service is, whether it's a streaming service or a cable service, you know, Comcast, DirecTV, whatever it is, that they would offer up all of the Oscar nominees for rent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that people can go see them way they're real estate. And I think that would increase interest in all of that. So
absolutely.
And I find it, and you know, and they could charge a premium for it, but it doesn't right now you're at that point where these movies are going from the theater to digital download within 70 something days.
It's 72 days for most movies, it's 30 days for Netflix movies.
How about that? All right. Thank you, Richard.
Sure.
Justin Kaufman is coming your way next right here on 720 WGN After News from Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Radio Chicago. WGN.